Brother.
Happy birthday to you.
Brother.
Happy birthday.
Hulk Hogan!
Happy birthday to you.
I'll be 102 years old, brother. Every day the Hulkster wakes up and he's not dead, brother. He's living on bonus time.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Who's that? You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 340 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, August 10th, 2014. I am the Solid Monster. Thank you, as always, for listening to the podcast and spreading the good word. You can listen to the show each and every week on thesolidmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, iTunes. We're also now on TuneIn Radio, so please follow us on there and give us a listen. We've got some great Hulk Hogan comedy later in the podcast ahead of his birthday bash, which is coming up on Raw this Monday night. Plus, spoilers from the TNA tapings at the Manhattan Center this past Tuesday. I was there along with Brian Blade and Webmaster Mike from SEScoops.com, so I'll have a full report on that later. But first, PayPal shout-outs to those who have donated to the show this past week. You can always make a PayPal donation to the show on thesolidmonster.com. Check the right-hand side. You'll see the PayPal box. Entirely voluntary. Give what you can, when you can. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. We have some shout-outs for Chuck Lunatic Lentz, James Hollywood Henderson, The Con Man, Michael Connolly, The Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra, Gavin Ghostface Rankin, the Leicester Defender, Sukdeep Puni, he's from Leicester, UK, Matt Game Over Gafurta, Wonderful William Clemenson, the Aristocrat, Duncan Kenway, Demolition Man Donovan McIntosh, Aiden Slap Your Face Sloan, Jolly John King, Marvelous Mark Cannon, and Radical Robin Tom. Thank you guys very much for the donations. Again, you can always make one on thesolidmonster.com. So before we get into it here, you know, I got to say, I was shocked when I heard that they released Mark Yeaton. WWE released the longtime timekeeper, over 30 years in the company. He was let go this past week as part of what I believe is cost-cutting. He was not a name I expected to see. You know, I remember Mark Yeaton. Obviously, people know him from being the one to throw Stone Cold his beers whenever Stone Cold appears on TV. But I remember the big bump he took at WrestleMania 12 during the Iron Man match. At one point during the Iron Man match, if you remember, Shawn Michaels accidentally super kicked the timekeeper. That was Mark Yeaton. He took a hell of a super kick during that match. So to me, that's the biggest memory of him that I'll have. But nobody is safe, not even former WWE champions. That was the other big story this week. Alberto Del Rio released by WWE. Put an announcement up on the website on Thursday that said, WWE announced the release of Alberto Del Rio due to unprofessional conduct and an altercation with an employee. And about a day or two later, on the WWE official Twitter account, there were two messages that were sent that talked about, basically, don't blame us, blame Alberto for acting unprofessionally. And it was very weird to see those kind of tweets sent from the WWE account. Triple H then retweeted them. And when I saw this, my spidey senses started tingling. I can't be 100% sure if this is legit or not. It seems legit. I'm going to guess that it is. I think that it is. Could it be a work? Sure. It's possible. It's just very bizarre the way that they handle this online. It's very different than normal circumstances when somebody is let go. But this is a different circumstance altogether because there was an incident that took place. This was not just, well, you know, we don't need him anymore, and so we wish him well in his future endeavors. He did something that he shouldn't have done, and they fired him for it. So it's entirely possible that it's a work. I don't think it is. I guess we'll find out on Monday night, because if there's any mention of Del Rio at all on that show, we'll know. And for the people saying, well, what sense would it make for it to be a work? I put nothing past these people. Look, I mean, if they wanted to do something out of the ordinary to get this guy going, Del Rio has been ice cold for a while now. He's had nothing going on at all. If they wanted to get him going, and what does Triple H call this? The reality era, whatever the hell that means, I would not be surprised. Nothing like that at all anymore would surprise me. So yes, it's possible, but assuming that this is all legit, the details of what happened have kind of sort of leaked out. There's multiple stories about what happened, but essentially what it sounds like happened is he slapped somebody with WWE's social media department at TV this past week. I don't know if it was Monday or Tuesday, but backstage one of those nights, he smacked somebody that he shouldn't have smacked. It may have been their social media director, this guy by the name of Corey Clayton, although I don't know if that's actually 100% confirmed or not. I've seen his name floating around. So, allegedly, there was a joke made in catering by the social media guy, whoever it was, about cleaning his plate off and how that's actually Del Rio's job. It was a racist joke. Del Rio found out about it. He tracked the guy down and confronted him and asked him to apologize. And when the guy didn't apologize, and supposedly the guy not only did not apologize, he may have actually smiled or smirked, that's when Del Rio smacked him. Now, if that version of events is pretty much how it went down, I don't know that I would have smacked the guy, but there would have been trouble. You know, Del Rio opted to slap him. I can understand that. At the end of the day, you can't go around smacking people at work, as tempting as that may sometimes be, I think, for all of us. So right now, with all the cost-cutting going on, they're looking for a reason to drop people, and he made it very easy for them to get rid of him. Now, had this happened a year ago, who knows? Who knows if the same thing would have happened? Maybe it would have just been a suspension. But times are different now. He did what he did. He's gone. There's a lot of people coming to Del Rio's defense. And again, we're just assuming that this version of events is true. It makes Del Rio almost look like a hero that he stood up to the guy. Del Rio is not a guy that you want to be messing around with either. He's a legit tough guy. So I'm having a hard time reconciling this in my head. If it is this social media guy, and if it is the guy whose name I mentioned, I've seen pictures of him online. The idea that he would make a crack and Del Rio would confront him angrily about it and he would refuse to apologize, it's a little far-fetched to me, but that seems to be the story that's going around as told by people in the locker room. It's just happenstance that Ricardo Rodriguez was released a week earlier. So both Ricardo and Del Rio, I guess pending their 90-day non-competes, now become free agents at the same time. I don't know what Del Rio's plans are, but it would make sense for the two of them to link up and go somewhere together as a package. They never should have been split up in the first place. I said that last week when I was talking about Ricardo on the podcast. TNA, for all the fun people make at their expense about how they're quick to snatch up ex-WWE talent, Dave Meltzer first reported that night, only a few hours after the news broke online that Del Rio had been fired, TNA was asking around for his phone number, trying to get in touch with him to bring up the possibility of putting the TNA title on him. That was the goal. They wanted to get in touch with him. They wanted to find out what was going on, see maybe if they could bring him aboard and possibly give him the belt. Meltzer wasn't being facetious. He was being serious. And I can totally believe that. You know, there's a nasty term called a star fucker that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. It's not a nice word. That's kind of what TNA has always been. You know, the people running TNA have always been star fuckers when it comes to ex-WWE guys, MMA fighters, reality show stars. So, of course, they would be interested in Alberto Del Rio. Honestly, in this case, I think Del Rio and Ricardo as a package deal could be a good addition to TNA. Now, can TNA afford them? Will TNA even be around in 90 days? That's the bigger question. I think they will be. I still think they're getting renewed by Spike. You know, Kevin Kay, the president of Spike TV, was at the tapings in New York on Thursday. He was shaking hands with some of the wrestlers. He was meeting everybody. That tells me negotiations are still ongoing and it's not a dead deal yet. That's a positive sign for TNA. Okay, there's a lot of other factors working against them at the moment. Like, even if they re-sign with Spike, will they be getting the same amount of money? Probably not. Can they survive on less? And then there's the issue of SmackDown, possibly moving to Thursday nights, which I'll talk about later. So I'm not even sure how realistic that is, that they would bring him in, but they were looking to get in contact with him mere hours after the news broke. So the interest is there. But boy, they sure didn't waste any time, did they? They are star fuckers. That is what they are. There's also the possibility of Ring of Honor. I don't see that happening. There's Jeff Jarrett's promotion, which keeps on announcing partnerships. It's like every day there's a new partnership that Global Force Wrestling announces, and yet they've announced nothing about a TV deal. Another week of no news. There's AAA, one of the two big promotions in Mexico. Del Rio competed there over a decade ago. They're expanding into the U.S. this fall. They're having a show on the El Rey Network later this year. I could see Del Rio being very attractive to them. He's got international name recognition now. Obviously, he's Mexican, but from all those years in WWE, traveling all over the world, being a world champion, he's got the name value. He's a face that people know. So we'll see. You know, he hasn't commented publicly on this yet. Maybe he can't legally. I'm very curious what his next move will be. As far as him in WWE, I've made no secret of the fact I call him, you know, Alberto Del Jabo, because that's how he's been booked. There's nothing appealing about the Del Rio character right now in WWE. They've done nothing with him. I said earlier, he's ice cold. Is this a work to try to get him going again with some kind of, you know, reality angle? I don't know. And I don't even know that it would work, quite frankly. But they've done nothing with the guy. Ever since they broke him and Ricardo up, it's just been downhill from there. They took away everything that made his character interesting. Everything that gave his character some flair and just separated him from everybody else. It was Ricardo, okay, having his personal ring announcer, and the cars. That was part of the whole package. And they stripped all of that away from him. Now, I know why they took the cars away, because they turned him babyface, and it was kind of a douchey move, I guess, to come out driving the nice car, a little pretentious. So they took that away. They sped up his entrance music. They gave him little Mexican flags, I think, to take down to the ring with him. It was kind of goofy. But once he turned heel and the babyface run failed, which it did, they should have gone back to the old entrance. You know, and I know he beat the hell out of Ricardo, so it would have been somewhat odd to put the two of them back together, but it's wrestling. You could always come up with a reason why, you know, Ricardo just, you know, he's like this indentured servant. He can't not be without Alberto. He doesn't know what to do with himself, you know. He's just got no life. He's got no family. Whatever the story is that you want to come up with, and you put the two of them back together. It's not like they were doing anything with Ricardo. He had that failed combo with Rob Van Dam, which was a complete joke looking back on that. They tried to turn him into an announcer. They already had two Spanish language announcers. They didn't really need him there. He would put the mask on as El Local and do some wrestling under the mask, and apparently they didn't really care much for that. So why not put the two of them back together? But they never did. Del Rio, to me, when I look back, if this really is it for him in WWE, I look at him as just never reaching his full potential. They wanted him so badly to be the next great Latin superstar, that kind of Eddie Guerrero was, I guess, in a different era, but maybe even bigger than that. They really wanted him to appeal to that audience, and they had high hopes for him. And they had high hopes for him when they brought him in as a babyface. You know, when he first came in, he was a heel, but long-term, they wanted him as this great big babyface character. So eventually they saw an opening. They turned him babyface. I remember when he won the World Heavyweight title from Big Show on SmackDown. I think they had a Last Man Standing match. It was in January, maybe 2 years ago, maybe. I forgot what year it was. But that was one of the best matches I've seen Del Rio have. Not just in terms of pure wrestling. He probably had better matches with Ziggler and Sheamus and all that. But in terms of the emotion, and like, that was a big win. I remember when he won the title that night, the place went nuts. As a matter of fact, I think, I want to say Webmaster Mike might have been at that taping. So it just feels like ever since then, it was all downhill. He had the feud with Swagger. I was at WrestleMania 29. What a dud of a match that turned out to be. The very next night, Ziggler cashed in Money in the Bank. People went nuts. They didn't give two craps about Alberto Del Rio. They never gave us a reason to. The guy would come out, he would have 5,000 matches with Dolph Ziggler. He'd have 8,000 matches with Sheamus. How many freaking times can you put these two people, the same combination of guys, in the ring together before you just go, enough, you throw your hands up in the air. It's like, I don't care anymore. I don't care who wins, I don't care who loses. I just don't want to see this match ever again. And that's kind of where I was at with Del Rio. I just did not care. I was kind of amused when he had that one time, that match on Raw with the original Sin Cara. And I think Sin Cara broke his finger, I think he dislocated it. He may have dislocated a finger. And Del Rio had no love loss with the original Sin Cara back from their days in Mexico. He just didn't like the guy. He didn't like him when he first came into WWE. He thought he was pompous. He thought he was full of himself. So I remember that match and Del Rio kind of being backed off by the referee. And Del Rio just got really pissed off, even though the guy was legitimately injured. And he threw him back in the ring and he started kicking the crap out of him. And the referee, I've never seen a referee get this forceful with a wrestler before. He shoved Del Rio back into the corner like, hey, dude, he's hurt. Enough. But Del Rio was just incensed at the fact that this guy would stop the match because he had a little finger injury. So he had a little bit of a mean streak in him. I could see him losing his temper. But again, it goes back to not reaching his full potential. Here's a guy who won the Royal Rumble, the biggest Rumble ever, 40 men. Okay, he won the Royal Rumble. He won the World Heavyweight Championship multiple times. He won the WWE Championship. He may have been the first Mexican-born WWE champion of all time. I think he was, actually, because I don't think Eddie was born in Mexico. He was Mexican-American, I believe. I think same thing with Rey. I could be completely wrong here, but I believe Del Rio may have been the first. So he had a lot of accomplishments. He accomplished a lot. When you look at his run in WWE over the last 3 or 4 years, he actually, you know, he reached the top there a few times, and he had a lot of pay-per-view main events and matches with guys like John Cena and CM Punk. And it just, he never felt to me like a legitimate main event star guy in that company. The face run was a bomb. And as a heel, he just never got over at that level. So he never reached his full potential. And I don't know if it's just, you could blame him, you could blame WWE, you could blame the presentation, you could probably blame a whole lot of different things. He just, to me, he never got to that level despite all of those accomplishments that I just ran off. I never looked at him as being that big of a deal. So to me, it's not a huge loss for WWE. It's another, you know, mid to upper card star gone, you know, at a time when they need more stars, not less. Maybe it opens up a spot for somebody down at NXT. You know, if they want somebody with, of Latin descent or whatever, they want to bring him up to the roster. Kalisto is certainly, I think, more than ready to come up. He hasn't been down at NXT for very long, but he's great, and I could see them trying to plug him in there as somebody to fill the role that Del Rio once had and Rey Mysterio once had, because Sin Cara certainly is not going to fill that role. Maybe they bring up Kalisto, maybe they just bring up somebody else from NXT. There's been rumors of Sami Zayn and The Ascension and other people they're going to bring up. So maybe him being gone opens up a spot for somebody else who can make the most of it, because Del Rio was on a path to nowhere. That's why I say him leaving is not that big of a deal. He wasn't really involved in any current storylines. He was just kind of there. To go back to what I had mentioned before about SmackDown, SmackDown, it looks like, is moving back to Thursday nights this fall. There's been no official announcement made by WWE or by Sci-Fi, but there have been multiple production trucks that have been photographed with new wraparounds on them advertising SmackDown, and the advertisements are very clear. It says SmackDown. It's got the new WWE Network logo on it, which I believe is going to debut, if not at SummerSlam, on Raw next week. So Raw this upcoming Monday night, the go-home show, is probably going to be it for the Scratch logo. I mean, maybe it'll be on SmackDown too, but this will be the last that we see, most likely, of that iteration of the Attitude Era Scratch logo. So another small piece of the Attitude Era dies, I think, after this week. So these new wraparounds on the trucks, they have the new logo. It clearly states SmackDown Thursday nights at 8, 7 Central on Sci-Fi. It's got the Usos on there. Those were not created by accident. So even though they're being very tight-lipped and they're saying that it's being negotiated, they're in talks, they haven't denied it, WWE, but they also haven't confirmed it, that tells me that somebody let the cat out of the bag a little early. I'm almost positive SmackDown will be moving to Thursday nights. I still, after all these years, I cannot fathom why SmackDown ever moved to Friday nights in the first place. And when they moved over to Sci-Fi, because I think the Friday night move predated even Sci-Fi. But there was another period where SmackDown moved. It must have been to a different network. And I thought then, finally, they're going to move it back into its original slot. And they never did. They kept it on Fridays. And I just was left scratching my head, like, why? Because all things considered, you know, Friday nights is not a good night for TV. SmackDown still brings in 3 million people, you know, in that range, give or take, which is not bad at all. But it's not close to what SmackDown used to do back when it was on Thursdays. Thursdays is a much better TV night than Friday. So does that mean SmackDown automatically now is going to pick up an extra, you know, 500,000 or a million viewers? I don't necessarily think that's the way it's going to work. I think it'll be a gradual thing. I do think that it'll be a positive for the show. Now, how that affects TNA and NXT is a different question. NXT is easy enough. NXT is under the WWE banner. All they need to do is just move it to a different night. They can move it to Wednesdays. They can move that to Fridays. It's not that big of a deal. I've gotten used to watching NXT on Thursdays. If they move it, to me, it's not the end of the world. I could just go back to watching Impact Live instead of watching it on DVR. TNA, though, needs to be concerned. Because if they end up sticking around on Spike and they stay in their current spot on Thursdays, moving SmackDown to Thursdays is going to take a chunk out of their audience. I don't know how big of a chunk, but it will definitely take a chunk. And the last time TNA went head-to-head with WWE, which was on Monday nights a few years ago, they got slaughtered. Just absolutely demolished. So being head-to-head against one of the top two shows that WWE produces every single week is not good news for TNA. And I don't know how that factors into whatever negotiations may be ongoing between them and Spike. If there's a discussion, maybe, if they do re-sign, of moving Impact to a different night, I have no idea what night that would be. And again, I think Fridays would be a downgrade. So that could be a bad situation for TNA if, in fact, SmackDown moves to Thursdays, which I'm almost positive it is. I would think in the next several weeks we'll have an official announcement from them or from Sci-Fi. So that's the update on SmackDown. There really is no new update other than what you guys have seen. It looks like it's true, and if I'm TNA between this and Thursday Night Football coming up soon, I'm probably sweating bullets right about now. Monday Night Raw this past week was live from Austin, Texas. Talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly. Some random Raw observations from this show. I can give you 999 reasons why I hated this show on Monday night, but I'll stick with just one. It was boring. Just a largely forgettable 3 hours of television. They also turned the WWE Network heel on this show. They went way overboard with the network plugs. $9.99 this, $9.99 that. That's going to be real awkward for Canadian fans in a few weeks when the network launches for $11.99. But, you know, I guess WWE logic is it's just Canada, right? So who cares? What was it that Vince McMahon said on that last investors call a few weeks ago? Canadians just have a different way of doing things. I don't know about you. If I were Canadian, I would take that as an insult. Maybe I'm reading that wrong, and he said it in a complimentary way. I hear that. I don't think complimentary. I think insult. You know, between that and all of the bizarro world references every time they go up there, and the fact that I cannot remember the last time they taped TV in Toronto. And I don't know why, I don't know what the deal is, but between all of those things, I don't know why Canadians support WWE so much when they don't seem to get the same respect back. Although, maybe the Bizarro World stuff is true, because last night in Vancouver, Randy Orton and Dolph Ziggler headlined the show. And not only did Dolph Ziggler kick out of the RKO, he pinned Randy Orton clean with the zigzag. I got the video up on my Twitter. He gave him a super kick and a zigzag and pinned him 1-2-3. Everybody was shocked. I mean, I know they like to send the crowd home happy in the main events, but still. I mean, you talk about shocking. So maybe there really is something to the Bizarro World stuff up there. I don't know. Anyway, they turned the network heel on Monday night. And I think, like the Steve Austin turn in 2001, this heel turn could backfire on them big time. It's one thing to promote the network, which they should absolutely be doing. But there's a smart way to do it, and there's a stupid way to do it. They chose the stupid way. I was just having a conversation with somebody about this a couple of days ago. In my opinion, people want three things out of this network. They want content. They want what that content is that you're offering them. Okay, they want to know that. And they want ease of use. They're lacking in all three areas right now. Yelling $9.99 in my face for 3 hours like a guy selling fake Rolexes on the street is not going to get me to subscribe to your network if I'm not already subscribed, no matter how many times you shout it. What am I getting for my $9.99? That's what I want to know. Focus on that. And speaking of the network, I know we have a lot of UK listeners. It'll be available in the UK starting October 1st. With Neither Man There live on Monday night, we got a Brock Lesnar-John Cena video package hyping their match at SummerSlam. I thought this was great. This is exactly the sort of thing I was hoping they would do to build this match up. They did a similar video with Brock when he first came back for the first match with John Cena. That was the one where he said Cena would have piss running down his leg. This time at the end of the video, to kind of punctuate it there at the end, Brock said he was going to leave John Cena in a pile of, and I quote, blood, urine, and vomit. What a visual that is. I thought Cena was good in this video. Brock was great. He made a great point about how, had I never left this company, there would be no John Cena. Which is exaggerating a little bit, but I think he makes a valid point in that if Lesnar had stuck around, you know, their goal was to make him this next big legendary figure in the company, and he didn't go anywhere, I still think John Cena would have ascended to the top babyface spot where he ended up anyway. It just would have taken a little bit longer. It wouldn't have happened as quickly. But I thought that was great, you know, him bringing up that point and bringing up their history together. And for the record, the promos by both of these guys in this video were supposedly not scripted. They were not written out. There was very little, if any, involvement from writers. It was just these two guys going out there, sitting down, and talking about their match and trying to make it seem like a real serious fight. And it's amazing how refreshing that could be, isn't it, when there's no writers and scripting involved? So I'm sure that had a lot to do with why this was so great. Randy Orton was out there in the opening segment dressed in a suit. And yes, he was wearing pants. So another streak dead in 2014. First Undertaker, then JTG, then Bo Dallas, now Randy Orton. Is nothing sacred anymore? I guess not. Roman Reigns beat Kane in a Last Man Standing match. And later in the night, no doubt fed up with all the $9.99 mentions for the WWE Network, Kane took off his wig mask and he walked out. And really, who can blame the guy? I'm sure it had nothing to do with his new movie coming out in a couple months, and it had everything to do with him being sick and tired of them plugging the stinking network. Mark Henry, he's back. He squashed Damian Sandow, who was out there dressed for a cheap heat as a Oklahoma Sooner. They were in Texas. Those Texans do not like Oklahoma Sooners. On SmackDown, Mark Henry and Big Show were put together as a tag team, so it looks like they're going to be together going forward. You guys know what I think of makeshift teams. Sometimes they work, like a Bobby Roode and Austin Aries and TNA, but more often than not, they're just a waste. But looks like they're a team now. Since they have no other teams, they have to take these two guys and put them together. Adam Rose had this weird segment backstage. He was back there with his Rosebuds partying, and there was a long frame mirror back there, and they were talking about the movie Oculus, which is a WWE film. It came out earlier this year. I guess now the DVD is coming out, and they did a deal where, I guess the whole thing with the mirror is when you look in the mirror, you see like an evil version of yourself or some stupid shit like that. So he looked in the mirror, and in his reflection, they showed Adam Rose dressed in a suit with a briefcase. As many of you pointed out, they missed a good opportunity, I guess, to dress him up as Leo Kruger, his former gimmick down in NXT. But really, who would know him as Leo Kruger anyway? You could have heard a pin drop probably if they would have had him dressed up that way. This segment would have been much better had it never happened at all. I just don't, you know, when they do something like this, obviously it makes Adam Rose look like a geek. He looks like a geek every week anyway, but I just don't see how this segment sold one single DVD. Was anybody watching this at all any more interested in watching Oculus before this segment aired? Or I should say after this segment aired than you were beforehand? If any of you say yes, you're lying. Not one of you would say that you were any more interested in seeing this stupid movie after this segment than you were before. So this was just a waste of time. I just don't see what something like this accomplishes. And there was no punchline. At least if you're going to do dumb comedy, try to have a punchline at the end of it. There was nothing. Dean Ambrose beat Alberto Del Rio in a beat-the-clock match. 15 minutes and 42 seconds, he beat him with his Dirty Deeds move. This was the gimmick they dusted off every now and then, is the beat-the-clock challenge. The idea being that Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins would each have a match on this show, and the person who won their match the fastest would get to choose the stipulation for their match at SummerSlam. So Ambrose won. Took him almost 16 minutes to get it done, but he won. Rusev beat Sin Cara on the WWE app. Yeah, we got entrances for a match. They went to commercial. When we came back, the match was over. And I love, and I've said this before, this is not the first time they've done this. Somebody needs to explain to these people what the word exclusive means. They talk about how exclusively on the WWE app, you know, Rusev just beat Sin Cara, and if you would have seen it, you saw it exclusively on the WWE app, and then 5 seconds later, they basically showed the entire match on Raw. So, it's not what exclusive means. Maybe to them it has a different definition. I guess it's kind of like them calling John Cena the most controversial superstar in WWE history. How many years did they call him the most controversial champion, the most controversial star in WWE history? And multiple times on this podcast, it would just irritate. It was one of those little things that just irritated me. And I would say, there's nothing controversial about John Cena. John Cena is the most straight-laced, boring top guy they've ever had. He never gets into trouble. He's like the Manchurian candidate of WWE. There is nothing at all controversial about this guy. What they mean is polarizing. He's the most polarizing. You can actually say that he is the most polarizing champion that this company has ever had. It's not necessarily right down the middle, but you have people who absolutely hate his guts, and you have the women and the children who love him. He's very polarizing. He gets different reactions from different people. Polarizing and controversial mean two totally different things, but they did this for months and for years. And then I mentioned it again on my show one week, and then the following Monday, actually the day after I said it on my podcast, you know, wouldn't you know, Michael Cole was on Raw calling him the most polarizing star in WWE. Thank God, at least they finally figured it out. So Rusev won the match. Lana is taking more jabs at Obama. She's praising Putin. Swagger and Zeb come out to confront them. We get a verbal showdown between Zeb and Lana. Rusev and Swagger, they end up brawling. Swagger got dumped out of the ring. And I thought for sure we were getting a Zeb beatdown here, that he was going to get put in the accolade. They did tease that he was going to get beat up, but then Rusev and Lana just left. They just walked away. A wasted opportunity to put more heat on this match going into SummerSlam, unless they're saving the beatdown on Zeb maybe for the pay-per-view. Would not surprise me if that was even the blow-off for the Zeb character, if it comes to him getting beaten up, you know? Swagger, look at it like this. Jack Swagger has had a career resurgence over the last month, month and a half, okay, with this feud. He got over more than anybody thought he would, and they're riding it out as much as they could. I think it comes to an end at SummerSlam. He's dead in the water whenever this feud runs its course. I don't see him winning. I still think they keep Rusev undefeated. They're saving him for the eventual big feud with John Cena. He's dead in the water when this feud runs its course. Swagger is. And if he stays babyface, it's a death sentence for the Zeb character. When it comes to like babyface managers, it's an absolute death sentence. So it wouldn't shock me at all if they did some sort of beatdown angle or injury angle with old Zeb. And that was it for him in WWE. I hope not. I like Dutch Mantel. I think he's a great talker, and I hope he has a place in the company for many years to come. But none of this at all would shock me. I mean, the only thing that I'm surprised by is they haven't already done an angle where he gets beaten up. And for the people who say, well, how can you do that? He's an old man. He's a grandfather. All of that is true. But I've said it before. He still wrestles from time to time. Some people don't realize that he's an actual wrestler. They don't even know who Dutch Mantel is. Do a Google search. Dirty Dutch Mantel. You would be surprised at the different people he's been involved with. He was very instrumental in the careers of Steve Austin, The Undertaker, Kane. He was a great booker in Puerto Rico. Some of the hottest periods in Puerto Rican wrestling were with him as the head booker. He was in TNA for a number of years because he was friendly with Jeff Jarrett. And I was always my understanding that he was kind of the brainchild behind the kind of serious MMA build to the Kurt Angle Samoa Joe cage match at one of the pay-per-views that did one of TNA's biggest buy rates ever. They did 60,000 buys for that show. Can you imagine a TNA pay-per-view coming anywhere close to that number here in 2014? And we're going back at this point probably 7 or 8 years. That's how long it's been. So, of course, after that pay-per-view, they were so successful with it that what did TNA do? They just went back to doing things the way they did before. And then when there were some political things going on and Jeff Jarrett fell out of favor, Dutch Mantel got his ass fired from TNA, which was a brilliant move on their part. Ziggler beat Cesaro. 2 minutes with the zigzag. Wow, he's beaten Cesaro and Randy Orton now within the time span of a week. I am color me skeptical here. I am very hesitant to get behind Dolph Ziggler as, you know, being out of the doghouse, and now they're finally going to do stuff with him. He's going to win the Intercontinental title at SummerSlam. Right now, I mean, I'll do my predictions on next week's show. I'm going with Miz at SummerSlam as far as who I think is actually going to win. You know, my pick right now is Miz to retain the Intercontinental title. I have no faith in this company at all when it comes to certain people. Dolph Ziggler is one of those people. I've been fooled before. The start and stop pushes. Until I see it with my own two eyes, I won't believe it. I hope I'm wrong. You can't blame me. You can't blame me for being a little hesitant now that he's picked up a few key wins. And it's almost like, you know, you're kind of hiding in the shadows and you start to peek your head out and you haven't seen sunlight in so long. You're kind of shielding your eyes, like, is it safe to come out? And then as soon as you step out, like, a Mack truck comes by and runs you over. Like, I'm not falling for that. So we'll see if this keeps up. But he beat Ziggler in 2 minutes on the show. You know your star has fallen when you're losing to Dolph Ziggler in a quick match, as Cesaro did here. Miz was on commentary. He got in the ring to confront Ziggler. When the match was over, Ziggler teased the super kick, but Miz bailed. Dolph kept telling Miz, this Sunday, like the pay-per-view was actually this weekend, so I'm sure they'll find a way to punish him for that. They always do. Stardust finally wrestled the match together, beating who else? Rybacksel. They're still searching for the Cosmic Key, which I assume is the tag team titles. You know, it really hit me when I saw Cody Rhodes here, and I know some people are really digging the Cody Rhodes character. I like how when he comes out, he kind of jumps up on the barricade, and he's acting all goofy, and, you know, again, I know some of you like the gimmick. I don't hate it. I don't have a problem with it, but I still don't know why any of this is necessary. You know, the Rhodes brothers got themselves over by going out and having great matches week after week after week for months. And then suddenly they were off TV, and of course, they cooled off. So then WWE spends time trying to figure out what the hell to do with these guys. How can we get them over again? And they saddle Cody with this dumb gimmick, which would be fine if, let's say, he and his brother weren't already over. What's wrong with letting these guys go out and have great matches? Just give them some new teams to face off against. They were one of the hottest acts in the entire company for a period of time last fall. And then, almost overnight, it ended. That's not their fault. All they had to do was keep it going. Just give them some new guys to wrestle with. Don't keep giving them the same teams over and over again. That's all you had to do. We had a bunch of filler segments I'm not going to bother with. You know, this is the problem with a 3-hour show. You just so many matches and segments that really just don't matter. Heat Slater and Seth Rollins in a beat-the-clock match. RVD had been announced as Rollins' opponent. They even played his music, I think, but he got pulled by the Authority. Obviously, they're trying to give Seth Rollins an easy opponent, so they gave him the one-man band. Time for Rollins here in this match to beat was 15 minutes and 42 seconds. That was the time set earlier in the night by Dean Ambrose for the right to pick the stip in their match at SummerSlam. And knowing what stipulation Dean Ambrose ended up choosing on SmackDown, I wish Rollins would have won this match. Dean Ambrose did come out during the match, and there were a ton of different distractions. He was doing everything in his power to take Rollins' focus off the match. And I will say, you know, you guys know I am no fan of the distractions and the distraction roll-up finish, which is what we got here. Heath Slater rolled up Seth Rollins and pinned him on a distraction roll-up. And I was not angry. This is one of those situations where it's okay to do a finish like this. And Dean Ambrose helped because he made it so damn entertaining. He was out there. He was pouring soda in JBL's hat. He poured soda. He took the Money in the Bank briefcase. And he opened it up, he ripped up the contract that was inside, he poured soda in there, he put JBL's hat in there, I think he may have taken a dump in there. I mean, he was just trashing this thing, and is pissing Rollins off more and more and more. Ambrose, very entertaining here, as he usually is. That's when Rollins got rolled up. The place went nuts. Heath Slater got a big win, kind of a big fluky win, very similar to the way that Hurricane beat The Rock back in the day off a distraction from Stone Cold Steve Austin, if you remember. So, I didn't have a problem with this. It's okay to do that finish every now and then when it fits. Here it fit. My problem is, and always will be, that they take something and they kill it. You know, it's like, we found something great. Let's hold it in our hands. Let's caress it. Let's brush its hair back. You know, feed it and just care for it and tend to it, and let's just squeeze it until its eyeballs pop out of its frickin' head. That's what they do with these finishes. They just beat it to death every single week, over and over again. It's lazy. It's lazy booking. But here it was fine. So on SmackDown, Ambrose chose as the big stipulation for their match that we've been waiting months for now, since they didn't do it at Battleground, he chose Lumberjack Match. Because nothing says grudge match like lumberjacks. I don't get why Dean Ambrose is so worried about Seth Rollins running away. He attacked Rollins backstage before their match at Battleground. That's why the match got canceled. Where does this fear come from that Rollins is going to suddenly just tuck tail and run away once the bell rings? I don't quite understand that. And I don't, you know, a steel cage match would make sense if that's how he feels. I would rather they not do a cage match because this should be a wild brawl. It should go all over the building, all over the ringside area. I would be perfectly fine just making it a street fight or some variation of that. He said lumberjack match. I'm just like, why? That didn't really make sense to me. I'm sure they're still going to have an excellent match. As a stipulation, kind of a letdown. We have the Stephanie McMahon-Brie Bella contract signing to end the show. My favorite part of this entire segment was Michael Cole, who was the MC in the ring, clearly on camera dozing off at one point. Maybe it was a bad camera angle, but to me it looked like he started to fall asleep. And I can't blame the guy because I was starting to fall asleep too. 3 hours, too long. As a segment, though, this was really good. I thought Brie Bella, what can be said, you know, on the microphone? She's serviceable, maybe is the right word for it. She's certainly not great. Stephanie is always great. You know, she's just been fantastic on the microphone in these things. So she carried, I feel like she carried the segment in that way. Nikki was out there with her sister. They did a deal where Triple H, who was also out there, he recused himself from the proceedings because he couldn't be fair. It is his wife, after all. He took the table that they had been using to sign the contracts on, because a brawl broke out, of course. He ended up kind of barricading Brie Bella in the corner with the table. That allowed Stephanie to attack her sister. She laid out Nikki with a pedigree. Brie broke free. She ended up being laid out with a pedigree, so Triple H has obviously been training his wife. She got a lot of boos, a lot of heat on Stephanie here at the end. I thought overall as a segment, this was really, really good. I enjoyed it. Second week in a row that the ladies have ended the show. I know it didn't do too well previously in the ratings. In fact, the show kind of took a nosedive there at the end, I think, the week before. And you can probably attribute that to the women being in the final segment. But I like the fact that they do that. I still like that, and I would continue to do it. Not every week. But I do think that it's going to take an education. You know, you've got to teach people that it's okay to stick around and watch the women do their thing in the main event. The fact that people are tuning out, I almost can't blame them for tuning out because for so long they've been told that the divas really aren't as important. They're not on the same level. They're the filler match. I started the diva stopwatch gimmick years ago. Why? Because they would literally give the divas 30 seconds. Now, it's a lot better now than it was, let's say, 3 years ago. It's still not great. They still give them only a few minutes to go out there and wrestle. But these things take time. It's kind of like when they started doing those ref stoppage finishes, where somebody would be in the corner getting the hell beaten out of them, and the referee would call the match off. That only started a few years ago. Before that, it was unheard of to have that kind of finish in WWE. And it would get booed. And I have to say, you know, when they use it most of the time, it's very, very lame. But there's a way to do it. There is a way to do a stoppage like that in a match where it would kind of make sense, even though the fans would probably still boo and they would be disappointed. But I think to some degree they've been educated to where when it happens now, unless it's really, really lame and they just let them know it, the fans kind of understand it. But it took time. You know, it takes time to condition them to understand these things and to realize, in this case, that, you know, the women can actually be the stars of the show on some weeks. And I think the Stephanie and Brie Bella storyline, I'm still a fan of it. I'm looking forward to seeing what they have in store. I've seen reports online floating around. Supposedly, they've already laid out the times for each match on the show. And, you know, this thing may get 15 minutes. And I'm sure it's not going to get 15 minutes to be a pure wrestling match. This is more of an angle than a wrestling match. I'm very intrigued to see what they have up their sleeve at SummerSlam. I have to comment on one more thing, though, before I move on. And this really angers me. There was no mention at all on the show about anything having to do with Xavier Woods, Big E, or Kofi Kingston. In fact, I don't think any of the three even appeared on the show. The previous week, their appearance was limited to the camera showing them standing backstage during maybe it was the tag team match, whatever the tag team match on Raw was 2 weeks ago. They showed the three of them backstage watching on a monitor. And that was it. There was never any follow-up in the form of an interview or anything. Xavier Woods is a great talker. I assume that was the reason they put him with these guys in the first place. I figured the following week, he would come out on TV, flanked by Kofi and Big E on either side of him, and he would cut this promo and let us know about this new unified faction, about what their goals are, about why they're united, why they're together. Never said a word. Never gave them any mic time. So this week, they weren't even on the show. Now I'm seeing reports, and I'm not sure where this is coming from, because I haven't read this from a reliable source, but maybe it's true, that WWE may have already dropped the whole storyline. There may be no faction. It may be dead before it's even begun. And you know what? It may well be true. Big E was on SmackDown this week. No Kofi. No Xavier Woods. I didn't see it, but I assume that means he was just out there as good old babyface Big E. Got squashed by Rusev. No mention of any of this other stuff. Just back to being a geek on the show getting beat in the middle of the ring. And it makes me angry, and I'll tell you why it makes me angry. WWE loves to talk about how Raw is a television show. It's not wrestling. It's not a wrestling show. It's entertainment. It's a TV show. We've been on the air for more years than Gunsmoke and ER and whatever other shows. You know, they always spit out these did you know facts, right? They're a TV show. Vince McMahon once said, we make movies. We make 2-hour movies every week. Of course, now those movies are 3 hours. So it's basically, you know, Vince McMahon loves to make Michael Bay movies every week. Is essentially what he's saying, right? They're full of action and drama and bad acting and all of these different things. And if you're going to call yourselves a television show, okay, or an entertainment show and not what you really are, which is a wrestling show, then I can sit here and tell you that Monday Night Raw is a bad television show. It is one of the worst television shows on the air, if you look at it strictly from that point of view. From the point of view of characters and all of that stuff. Because if I was watching any other show on television, a non-sports, non-wrestling show, okay, a drama that had acting and storylines, or a comedy, it could be either one, but let's say a drama on TNT or a network like that, or AMC, which has some great shows, The Walking Dead, okay? If I was watching any other television show, and they introduced three new characters to me, or they took three existing characters on the show and their storylines took a turn where they came together. It was some kind of new storyline that was developed on an episode. It got people really interested and really excited to see where it was going to go. And the very next week on that television show, there was no mention of those characters at all. They weren't even on the freaking show. And then a week after that, one of the characters is on the show, but he's right back to doing what he had been doing 3 weeks earlier. It's almost like what we saw never happened. Can you fathom any other television show on the air right now pulling a stunt like that and what people would think of that? That would be bad television, wouldn't it? That would be an awful television show. That's what Raw is when they pull shit like this. I was genuinely interested to see what direction they were going to go in with these guys. Is it going to be a new Nation of Domination type faction? Is there a racial component to it? Is it not race? They just so happened to be three black wrestlers, but maybe there was another reason why they were coming together. Maybe, and I didn't think they were going to push the envelope like they did back in 1997, because that was a different time. That was the Attitude Era. That was the birth of the Attitude Era in 1997. I mean, I would say it goes back even further to the end of 1996, but that was definitely not a PG era. Now we're in a PG era, okay? I didn't expect it to be the same thing. But I expected them to follow up on their own freaking story. They never did. And it looks like it may be dead in the water. Which also means that Kofi is still going to be dead in the water. Xavier Woods is dead in the water because they're not going to do shit with him. Big E, maybe at some point they'll wake up and do something with him. But right now they're doing a whole lot of nothing. And to me that makes your show a bad television show. Now, maybe they're just waiting until after SummerSlam. They don't have anything right now. They don't want to rush into a match, let's say, with Big E and Kofi against the Usos. Maybe they're going to build that up after SummerSlam. Maybe I'm wrong. And they're just holding off on it one more week. But sure doesn't seem like that to me. It seems like Vince McMahon got bored and they moved on. Plans change, right? That's their official, that's the slogan of WWE. Plans change. They should put that on all their stationery and all their materials with their new logo. Plans change. That sucks for you and me. We sit through 3 hours of this shit every single week and finally we find something that seems mildly intriguing. And they pretend like it never happened. Right back to the same old status quo bullshit that they give us every single week. That's a bad television show right there. And if this were anything else, I mean, I've been a wrestling fan my whole life. I'm not going to give up so easily and just stop watching the show. If this were any other television show, I would. I wouldn't watch that show the week after that. Are you kidding me? They get way more chances than most other shows on TV would get, and I think they take that for granted. Because they know that you and I and all the other schmucks who watch their show are going to come back the following week. It's like what Triple H said in that promo, right? Me and my friend Mark, we're not going to watch, except we are. You know what, though? He's right. He's right. And we let them get away with it. And that sucks. This Monday night is the go-home show to SummerSlam, and WWE is hyping a birthday celebration for one Hulk Hogan, whose birthday is tomorrow, August 11th. He turns 61. And a lot of rumors out there that there's going to be an NWO reunion. Kevin Nash, Scott Hall may be there. Scott Hall was teasing it on Twitter last Monday. So between that and a lot of the reports out there, it would make sense if they were promising surprises. That would certainly be something I think that would get a nice reaction from people to see the original NWO back together in the ring. Hopefully, just for one night only. So I expect them to be there, and I think Ric Flair, Paul Orndorff, also expected to be there. Jimmy Hart, of course, he goes wherever Hogan goes. How great would a Mega Powers reunion have been in a segment like this? You know, with the handshake and everything. You got to do the authentic Mega Powers handshake. It's too bad. There's also the question of whether or not WWE would book Sting for this segment. He's been a big part of Hogan's career. You know, with Sting, I am looking forward to Sting's first Raw appearance, whenever that may be. And it is going to happen. I guarantee you it's going to happen. I would be disappointed if they wasted it on this, though. You know, 25 years without a single in-ring appearance for WWE, and they blow his first one on Hulk Hogan's birthday party. You know what I mean? Surely they could do better than that. I haven't heard any other names. Maybe they have another one or two surprises up their sleeve. Maybe Sting is one of them. I don't know. But I thought that as we prepare for the Hulkster's big birthday bash on Monday, I would talk about this. He did an interview last Sunday, so a week ago today, promoting the WrestleMania special that aired on NBC, which did not include Daniel Bryan, by the way. It was only an hour long. I get that. And they wanted to go for the big names, so they had Hogan, they had Austin, Rock, that whole segment they aired, I think. But yeah, no Daniel Bryan, the same Daniel Bryan who wrestled twice on that show and won the WWE Championship in the main event, was not on the WrestleMania special. You would never even know that he was part of the show. But anyway, Hogan was interviewed, and he shared some more great Hoganisms with us, and I just had to share them with you. These are always entertaining. Some of these notes that I've cobbled together here come from a report that was sent into the Observer, and I've added some to this myself. Hogan claimed during this interview that he was once scouted by both the New York Yankees and the Cincinnati Reds to play baseball, but unfortunately an injury cut short his playing career. The same way a finger blister, I'm sure, stopped him from joining Metallica, which is another tall tale that he's told over the years. You know, how he used to be big pals with Lars Ulrich, and he auditioned for Metallica. Meanwhile, Lars Ulrich has no recollection whatsoever of ever being in the same room with Hulk Hogan, let alone being good friends with him. You would think he would remember that, given that, you know, Lars Ulrich, I don't know how many of you know this, but he has a photographic memory. He's talked about this before. And so between that and the fact that Hogan is no ordinary guy, okay, wasn't he like 6'4" when he was in high school, like over 200 pounds? He was no ordinary kid when he was younger. He's never been ordinary. So that was another story he's told. He also once famously claimed that while he was working for TNA, he said this, that he used to wrestle Pride fighters back in the 70s, even though Pride MMA did not open until the late 1990s. He also said that he led his team to winning the Little League World Series. That's a change from the story he told a few years ago, which was that he played in the Little League World Series, and he was the star pitcher, but his manager pitched him too much, and his arm got tired, and he gave up the game-winning grand slam to the opposing team. None of that is true, by the way. Apparently now the story is he actually won the game. I guess never one to want to do the job, even at 12 years old, I guess. He's told other stories, and we're not even talking about the interview from last week anymore. I mean, I could go on and on here. He's claimed he was an all-state pitcher in high school, which is another story he's told. It came out that he never even played any sports in high school. The Wrestler. Remember that movie? Hogan was on Howard Stern once. He claimed that Darren Aronofsky offered him the lead, but he turned it down, so it went to Mickey Rourke instead. As soon as he heard that, Aronofsky went on Twitter and denied that Hogan was ever even considered for the role, let alone offered anything. I mean, I could just keep going here. I mean, with the time zone difference, this is a great one. This is a fantastic one here. He once said that with the time zone difference, when he would go back and forth years ago between the U.S. and Japan, he once worked 400 days in a single year. 400 days. He talked about once partying with John Belushi after WrestleMania 2, even though Belushi had already been dead for years. It doesn't sound like a very fun party to me. You know, maybe they party Weekend at Bernie style and they drag Belushi's corpse around town. There was the one where he got a sick kid. Now, I'm not trying to make light of a sick kid here, but he told this story where he once got a sick kid a ticket to SummerSlam at Wembley Stadium back in 92 to watch him in the main event. And then he looked out into the crowd that night and he saw the empty seat and he knew that the kid had died. And so that compelled him to write a song about it, which he did. It's a real song that he wrote. I think Hulkster in Heaven is what it's called. The only problem with that story is Hogan wasn't at SummerSlam that year. He wasn't even in the UK. You know, body slamming all 800 pounds of Andre the Giant at WrestleMania 3 and tearing every muscle in his body, and then a few days later, Andre died. I mean, Hogan is an amazing person. I mean, it's pathological with this guy. You know, he just can't help himself. I still have a soft spot for the Hulkster. I mean, he's got the best entrance music of all time. I grew up on the guy. And you know what? When you look at how many guys from his era aren't around anymore, and all the drugs and all the steroids, I'm happy he's alive to see his 61st birthday. So I, for one, am looking forward to his little birthday bash. I don't mind. As long as it doesn't take up the entire show, and they sell the pay-per-view, which should be the key goal of Raw Monday night, to sell people on SummerSlam, I don't have a problem with it. I just hope if he's going to be there, he tells some other stories. So God bless the Hulkster. There really is nobody else like him. We had Rich Brennan, Alex Riley, and Jason Albert as our announce team this week on NXT. Albert officially announced his retirement this week. He had recorded a video, I think it was up on the WWE YouTube channel, of him at the Performance Center talking about all the things they're doing down there. He considers himself retired now. He is a coach slash announcer, I guess. And I have to say, you know, after watching this show on Thursday, I like him as an announcer. I'm really digging the work that he's doing. He has a lot of potential, I think, in that role. The story of this week's show was it was the beginning of the number one contenders tournament to crown a new number one contender for the NXT Tag Team Championship to challenge the Ascension. We opened the show with a first round match in that tournament. Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy beat Jason Jordan and Ty Dillinger. And Jason Jordan has cut off his afro. He has cut off all of his hair, which means now he just looks like everybody else. Finish of the match saw Jordan pick Enzo up for his move. Colin Cassidy slid in, delivered a big boot to the kisser on Jordan, which knocked him out, and Enzo kind of fell on top of him and got the pin. So a big win for the Italians. Referee was busy getting Ty Dillinger out of the ring and didn't see any of this. That's why there was no DQ called. So they move on in the tournament. I actually have the tournament brackets open here. since they won their match, they will now meet the winners, or the winner, I should say, of the Vaudevillains against Mojo Rawley and Bull Dempsey. And in the other part of the tournament, it is going to be Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel. They were in the main event this week against Sami Zayn and Adam Rose. I'll get to that later. The winners of that match will take on the winners of the Sin Cara and Kalisto against Wesley Blake and Buddy Murphy match. So those are the brackets. We had Renee Young back to her roots as the backstage interviewer this week. No Devin Taylor, which is a welcome change. We had Renee back in that role, reunited here with Sami Zayn. They make a cute couple. Just don't tell Ambrose I said that. Sami said that he had no partner for tonight's main event against Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel, so who should come into camera view at that point and talk smack to young Sami but Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel. So that eventually brought out Adam Rose, who popped into camera view. He said he would be Sami's partner tonight. He then handed his lollipop, which was in his mouth, to Sami Zayn, and Zayn reluctantly put it into his mouth. And I could tell you, as somebody who considers himself a mild germaphobe, I found this revolting. CJ Parker and Xavier Woods, and hopefully the blow-off to their epic feud, epic as in epically boring. It was so boring that we had another wave from the NXT fans here during this match. There was one cool spot I have to point out, though, towards the end, and I think this should have been the finish. I think it was a mistake that it wasn't. There's a cool spot where CJ Parker is down on the mat. I think he may have been rolling away from Xavier Woods. He's down on the mat close to one side of the ring. Meanwhile, on the opposite side of the ring, Xavier Woods is standing on the ropes. Not even the top rope. I think he kind of, almost like Undertaker style, started to walk out onto the rope. And from the top rope on that side of the ring, he leaped to the other side for a splash on CJ Parker. They called it a coast-to-coast, which it wasn't exactly a coast-to-coast, but I guess kind of it was. Only got a two count. So I thought that was kind of a letdown. That kind of move should end the match. CJ Parker came back. He nailed a Death Valley driver for the three count. So finally, this feud is over. Or is it? I don't know. We'll find out. Backstage, Tyler Breeze said it's time to challenge Adrian Neville for the NXT title. Didn't say when. Bayley and Eva Marie. Eva Marie on NXT. You know, I'm torn here. I'm torn here because on the one hand, developmental is probably the right place for Eva Marie to be. On the other hand, I have to watch Eva Marie matches on NXT, and that's just a recipe for disaster. The fans eviscerated this poor girl, chanted, "You can't wrestle" at her all throughout the match. And supposedly, when this match was over, I don't know if this is true or not, but supposedly when the match was over and she went backstage, she was in tears. Eva Marie went backstage because of the reaction that she got and the catcalls and everything. She went backstage and she cried. And, you know, I kind of feel bad for her, but I have to say, if you're the kind of person who's going to hear those kind of chants from the crowd and you can't handle it and you're just going to go backstage and cry and put your face in your hands, you know what? You're probably in the wrong line of work. If that bothers her so much, she better get used to it. That's all I got to say. And maybe over time she'll get better. But right now she's no good. And if you're going to run backstage and cry because the people said bad things about you, you probably should find a new line of work for yourself. This match was really not good. You know, Bayley tried to hold it together. Eva Marie at one point executed a suplex and didn't mess it up, so I guess that's a positive sign. But otherwise, just not a good match. Bayley won with the belly to Bayley and got chance when it was over of "Thank you, Bayley." So that was Eva Marie's first experience in the NXT arena. And in the main event, first round match of the tag team tournament, Sami Zayn and Adam Rose beat Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel. If you look at the brackets, assuming that Kalisto and Sin Cara win their first round match, I can't say that I agree with the outcome here. I just don't understand the logic behind it. I mean, you know, Sami Zayn, he hit his big-ass dive over the top rope to the floor. Adam Rose followed up with a big flip dive of his own. Landed badly. He hit part of the ramp, I think his ass or his lower back. Sami Zayn got in the ring, hit the Helluva kick in the corner on Justin Gabriel, got the pin. It's always nice to see Sami Zayn get a win, but I just feel the wrong team won this match. You know, Tyson Kidd has a lot of momentum right now on this show. He really does. And I know that many weeks ago he was on Superstars, and apparently he played a totally different character. I think he was actually a babyface on the show. There was never any acknowledgement at all of the ongoing storyline on NXT. I guess they try to think of NXT as a completely different, independent show, but you can't do that because now it airs on the network. Essentially, they've launched NXT as its own brand, and it's on the network. So you and I and everybody who has the network who watches Raw every week can very easily watch NXT. For them to just ignore it, and it's almost like two different versions of Tyson Kidd. It goes to what I said earlier when I was talking about the Xavier Woods, Kofi Kingston, Big E stuff, and how insulting that is and how it makes for bad television. You can't just ignore stuff like that. But anyway, on this show, he's got a lot of momentum. I really dig the Tyson Kidd character and the fact stuff and all that. And Justin Gabriel is another guy who I think is underutilized. He should be at least a little bit higher up on the food chain than he is right now. And I think together, I like the combination of the two of them on the show. And I don't understand why not only they lost to a makeshift team like Sami Zayn and Adam Rose, who do not have a future together as a tag team. It's not as though this is the new team on NXT. And going forward, they're going to beat the Ascension and win the belts. I sure as hell hope not. And they're going to go ahead and have this long, lengthy reign with the titles. Adam Rose is already on the main roster. A lot of rumors that Sami Zayn will be headed there soon enough as well. They're going to be doing their own thing independently. Singles competition. You know, I assume they put the two of them together ultimately to lose in this tournament. Why bother having them go over Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel, who have more long-term potential, I think, as a team, even on the main roster, perhaps? And I personally think that you would get a lot more out of a Tyson Kidd-Justin Gabriel match against Kalisto and Sin Cara, heels against faces. And I think Kidd and Gabriel could give them a hell of a match. Whoever is supposed to go over there, you know, maybe the heels, so they match up with the Ascension, who's been more baby faces of late. But I think there's a hell of a lot more potential in a Tyson Kidd-Justin Gabriel match against Sin Cara and Kalisto than against Sami Zayn and Adam Rose. I just think it's a more appealing match, and it would have made more sense to do it that way, but I guess they felt differently, so the babyfaces went over in this match. It wasn't a bad match. It was actually pretty good. We saw a side of Adam Rose we don't get to see very often on TV these days, which is more of a wrestler. You know, he was really busting out a lot of moves and the dives and everything else. So he looked pretty good. Sami Zayn always looks good in these matches. It was good stuff. Good episode this week, despite Eva Marie. Thank you guys for taking time out of your day to listen to The Sound Off. I get questions from people asking, how can I support the podcast? Well, the best way to support the show is simple. Just keep listening each and every week. Keep spreading the word about it to friends and family and retweet or share links to the episodes on Twitter and Facebook. But beyond that, you can contribute by making a PayPal donation or by signing up for a free 30-day trial of the Audible.com service. Making a PayPal donation is simple. Just log on to thesolemonster.com and you'll see the PayPal donation box on the right-hand side of the page. Enter whatever amount you'd like and click the Make a Donation button. That's it. Or sign up for a free Audible trial by entering our custom URL, audibletrial.com/solemonster. From there, you can sign up free for 30 days, which helps us out. You get one free audiobook as part of your trial that you get to keep no matter what. And you can browse through their library of over 150,000 titles. Listen to your books at home, on the commute to work, at the gym, whenever, wherever. Sign up at audibletrial.com/solemonster or visit thesolemonster.com to make a donation right now. And thank you for supporting The Sound Off. Finally made my Impact debut this past Thursday night. Still haven't been paid yet. I'm sure the check is in the mail. Hope it doesn't bounce when I try to cash it. The entire episode on Thursday night was built around Bully Ray putting Dixie Carter through a table, which they spoiled on their own show the week before. Yet on this show, the announcers played it up like, will Dixie go through a table tonight? I don't know. Like, they had to pretend like they didn't know, which just made them look like idiots. We had Bram against Abyss. Monsters Ball match. I'm not going to go into too many details here because these matches took place on the taping that I went to back in late June on that final night. They definitely did some mixing and matching on the show. The fact that I was even on the show, you know, tells you right there that they were mixing segments because I was not there for the Dixie table bump. That happened the night before. So almost every single thing you saw on this show was taped, let's say, I think it was on June 27th. What you saw at the end of the show took place on the 26th, so why they're mixing this way, I don't know. But Bram beat Abyss in the opening match, Monsters Ball, brutal match, lots of blood, thumbtacks. I had a front row seat for this. It was just, you know, again, it's hard to get into stuff like that these days. I don't know if I've just been desensitized to it. I just saw Bram tearing his body to shreds. I mean, Abyss does that all the time. That's just what he does. But Bram is out there just tearing his body to shreds, and I'm like, he's doing this for TNA. This guy's crazy. He's nuts. Bromans and DJ Z beat Gunner, Mr. Anderson, and Sam Shaw. After Anderson got rolled up by Robbie, he was more concerned about getting up in Sam Shaw's face, and it cost him. He wasn't paying attention. Anderson was not happy about having to team with, as he referred to Shaw during their ring intros, this freaking guy. That's what he called him. We had Bully Ray, Tommy Dreamer, D-Von, and Al Snow as the surprise fourth member of the Babyface squad, beating EC3, Rick Lon, Gene Snitsky, and Rhino in a War Games-style street fight. This went a long time. I also was not there for this, so this was the other thing that got taped the night before I was there. They never mentioned anything about it having War Games rules. You just kind of had to figure it out for yourself as the match went along. It started, and then about every 90 seconds or 2 minutes thereafter, they would run a countdown clock. Another member of the opposing team would then come out until everybody had been called. It was one fall to a finish. They said there was a coin toss backstage. They didn't show us. So this was basically a War Games match without the cage and without the two rings. And so as far as brawls go, it was pretty good. You know, it was a lot of weapons, a lot of mayhem. They were all in at the same time. Very, you know, Texas Tornado style. EC3 bled. He got busted open at one point. Al Snow, again, he was a surprise. He came out with head. They had already handed out styrofoam heads to everybody in the crowd, which looked goofy that they just so happened to have their heads when Al Snow came out. Lots of "we want head chants." Taz made a comment to the effect of "me too." I mean, that's just an easy, I mean, come on, that's a slam dunk right there. But yeah, I mean, you know, Al Snow and head, I have to say, Al Snow, he looked in tremendous shape for a guy his age. He's about 50 years old almost, I think. Hasn't really wrestled in a while. He was in really good shape. I think he's got some kind of competition on Twitter going on with Dave Hero and Damian Nelson. I think they're doing some kind of like fitness challenge to see who can like muscle up and or lose weight or whatever it is they have going on. It's working for Al Snow, I can tell you that. He did an acai moonsault at one point off the ropes onto all the heels on the outside. He looked good, but again, I could do without the ECW nostalgia. It's just, you know, week after week, it's the ECW reunion show. And at some point, you just kind of get sick and tired of that. So anyway, the Babyfaces won 3D on Rhino to end the match. Beautiful people came out. Gail Kim and Taryn Terrell eventually came out, so all four women were in the ring. The end result here is Gail Kim saying she was going to defend her title against all of the other women in an upcoming match. It ended in a brawl. Nothing more to it than that. Samoa Joe, Sonata, and Low Ki in a three-way match for the X Division Championship. Not a long match at all, you know, the War Game style brawl I just mentioned that went like 15 minutes or something. This match went maybe 7 or 8, maybe. So it never could reach that level of greatness. I wouldn't call it a great match, but it was really, really good. Some hard-hitting action in there, obviously, between Joe and Low Ki. But in the end, Joe got the win with the Coquina Clutch, got the tap out from Sonata. He is the new X Division champion. This is the part where they put the camera on me in the front row, and I got some screen time for about 5 seconds on Impact. I was cheering for Joe when the match was over, and I am a big Samoa Joe fan. I made no bones about that on the show before. You know, I'm a big Joe fan, and he was certainly underutilized for a long time in TNA. Now he's the X Division champion again. He should probably be wrestling for the world title, but that's neither here nor there. Brian Blade next to me, for whatever reason, looks like he's rocking out at a rave party back in his college days. He's having a ball. All you guys let me know right away. You were sending me screen caps, and somebody created an animated GIF of me chanting for Joe, and I guess I'm a meme now on our Facebook group. I'm not quite sure how I feel about that, but that was pretty cool. And I think me and Brian both, we're going to be on Impact probably for the next 3 or 4 weeks, because I'm pretty sure next week's show is the second taping that we were at. We're definitely on that show. And after that, they're probably starting with the most recent tapings, and me and Brian and Webmaster Mike went to night one of those tapings, so we'll probably be on Impact for the next month or so you can watch for us. So that was a lot of fun. It was just a fun match, and you know, good to see Joe get something going for himself. He's had not a lot going on. Now he's got a belt. We'll see how long he holds on to it for. And then finally, the main event of the evening. I know, my appearance wasn't the main event. What's up with that? Main event of the evening was Dixie Carter. Now, Dixie Carter was so concerned about getting put through a table, and certainly had plenty of warning from Bully Ray all night long, basically looking at her and going, "Yo, bitch, I'm putting you through a table." And Dixie's all worried, and she's got King Mo with her from Bellator as her bodyguard. You would think that knowing this, Dixie would leave. She would hightail it out of there. But no, Dixie comes to the ring. She goes into the ring, the least safest place in the entire building, and she goes to the ring. And she's got EC3 with her, and Spud, and Ricklon, and Snitsky, and they're all out there. And Dixie is not happy at Ezekiel Jackson, Ricklon, whatever, and Snitsky for losing the match earlier in the night. They were part of that big War Game style match, and they lost, and she pinned it all on them, and so she fired them. She called them a bunch of has-beens, which begs the question why you would say that when the perception of you is already pretty low, and you brought these guys in. Now you're readily calling them has-beens on TV. So that was a weird insult for her to hurl at them. But that's what she called them, and you know, poor Ezekiel Jackson, fired twice now. Twice in the span of a month. Poor bastard. Tommy Dreamer, Bully Ray, D-Von, they came out with a table. Had the word Dixie sprawled on it. Brawl broke out. Bully Ray actually took down King Mo, which is comical on so many freaking levels. I can't even begin to talk about that. Rockstar Spud tried to bring Madam Dixie to safety when the entire roster, all the babyfaces, walked out. They were not going to let Dixie get away on this night. And Tommy Dreamer put her in the ring. D-Von put her up on Bully's shoulders and off the ropes for a powerbomb through a table came Bully Ray, and ding-dong, the witch is dead. Dixie Carter takes a table bump. Now, if you watch this, you could tell that she really didn't go through the table at all. It was all Bully's ass. He basically sat through the table. He took the brunt of the bump through the table. And I see people saying, well, she didn't get hurt at all, so how could she have broken bones in her back? She did break two small bones in her back. I mean, look, it was a rough bump. She may not have gone through the table, but that was a bad landing. You could tell once they hit the mat, her body was kind of like in a weird position. She was kind of trying to squirm out of there. She didn't land in a great way. I mean, I think Bully did everything he could. I don't know what else he could have done to protect her. At the end of the day, she's almost 50 years old. She's a 50-year-old woman who has no business being in the ring. If you're going to take a bump, shit happens. And that's what happened. She got hurt. She broke her back. It's not Bully's fault. His ass took the brunt of it through the table. But when you smack the mat, and keep in mind, one of the criticisms of the six-sided ring when they announced they were bringing it back many years ago, I don't know, maybe the ring now is different. Maybe it's maybe they've softened it or loosened the ropes or something. But when they used to have the six-sided ring, one of the knocks on it was a lot harder to bump in that ring. When you would land on it, on the mat, it was a lot stiffer, there was a lot less give, and it hurt your body. So she landed not just on any mat, she landed on the mat in a six-sided ring that probably is not very kind to your body. So it was a rough landing, she got hurt, she was laid out, everybody cheered, all the baby faces are high-fiving. I high-fived myself just because that needs to be it for Dixie Carter. The character is dead. She is written off. If TNA survives and they renew their TV deal and they move on, I don't care for how many more months or how many more years they survive and they live on, and I hope they do, she does not need to be on that television show ever again. It was the perfect blow-off. She went through the table. She broke her back. Goodbye. Adios. The end of Delusional Dixie here on this show. I can't hate on this show for that reason alone. They blew off the Dixie Carter character. Let's hope for TNA it's not the blow-off of TNA as a company, which was a thought that was going through, I think, a lot of people's minds as they were watching the show on Thursday. It could be more than just a blow-off for the character. It could end up being a lot bigger than that, depending on how things end up. TNA did something very, very odd when the show was over. They put out a press release. Now, I talked about this on the show last week. There's a lot of controversy in the media about the whole Ray Rice situation. He's the NFL player who was caught many months ago on surveillance video coming out of an elevator, dragging his unconscious wife or girlfriend, whatever she was at the time, out of the elevator because he knocked her the fuck out, is what he did. It was a domestic violence case. And there were people who said, well, you know, surely Spike TV cannot air the segment because they have a policy of no man-on-woman violence, and the Ray Rice thing, it would be in poor taste. There was never any doubt in my mind the segment was airing, and it had to air because it was the blow-off to something you've been building for 4 months. You can't build that up for 4 months and then on TV last week spoil it and say it happens and then the next week black it out. Like, that was never going to happen. I don't know why any of you would have believed that. So of course they aired it. But one thing I wouldn't do is I wouldn't exactly draw attention to it. You know, TNA is not drawing any mainstream fans out of this angle. Hopefully they popped a big number for that segment. Impact was up this week. It wasn't up, like, astronomically. I think it was the highest rated Impact in, like, 2 weeks or 3 weeks. How that final segment did, I don't know. But the best you could hope for with something like that is that your hardcore wrestling fans are going to be interested to see this woman be put through a table, and they'll tune in. Are any non-wrestling fans really going to tune into TNA Impact to see Bully Ray put his boss, Dixie Carter, through a table? Of course not. But what TNA went ahead and did, their PR people, is they put a press release together and they sent it out to the media. Must-see clip as prominent entertainment president slammed through table by employee. Bully Ray delivers on promise to drive TNA president Dixie Carter through table. Okay, that's just the headline. During tonight's broadcast of Impact Wrestling, TNA president Dixie Carter was raised atop Bully Ray's shoulders and smashed through a table. Her broken body lying in the center of the ring until EMTs could come to her aid in front of a sold-out Manhattan Center crowd in New York City. The incident has taken social media by storm with hashtag It Happens. For months, Bully Ray and Dixie have been in a heated feud, with Bully promising for weeks to put Dixie through a table. Tonight, it happened. And then at the bottom, you know, I should professionally read press releases out loud for companies. At the bottom, they have a section called visuals, and they have links to a lot of different visuals, including a clip of Bully putting Dixie through a table, downloadable photos of Bully slamming Dixie through a table, downloadable memes of Bully slamming Dixie through a table, and a downloadable GIF of Bully slamming Dixie through a table. This is all in the press release. I read this and I just thought to myself, how tone deaf can you be? You know, it's one thing to do the angle. I never thought they shouldn't have aired it. I'm happy they did. But to then put a press release out saying, hey, look, we've got photos and video and memes and all of these things of Bully Ray slamming this woman through a table. You know, I guess in their view, it was all tongue-in-cheek. It wasn't played up as tongue-in-cheek on TV, I can tell you that. It's been their primary feud for 4 months now. Their top storyline in this company, it wasn't played for comedy or jokes. So, I guess they were just trying to get some mainstream publicity out of it. I don't know why you would ever think that this would get you mainstream publicity. Even if they put King Mo through the table, that wouldn't have gotten them any mainstream publicity outside of some MMA websites. So to put a press release together that's headline basically says, hey, take a look at us. We had a guy on the show put a woman through a table. Look at us. I don't know. That just strikes me as being very tone deaf. But hey, that's TNA. Now, let's move on here because I was at the tapings on Tuesday night. They came back to the Manhattan Center for another set of three tapings. Actually, six, technically, over the course of three nights. I was at the first night of tapings with Brian Blade and Webmaster Mike, so if you don't want to know anything that happens on upcoming episodes of Impact, if you want to be spoiler-free, you're going to have to skip ahead by several minutes, because this is going to be chock-full of spoilers here. First, let me just say this. I always love meeting fans of this podcast. Whenever I go to a big show like a WrestleMania or anything, it blows my mind in a building with 70,000 people. People will pick me out of the crowd and will find me and come over to me. I still remember, I think his name was David. He may be listening now. Fan from Ireland. He was at WrestleMania in Miami a few years ago. And the show ended. And you have 75,000 people now filtering out of the stadium. And he kind of tapped me on the shoulder and found me. And I was just blown away by that. So I always love meeting fans of the show. And I met a whole bunch of you guys on Tuesday night. You found me and we kind of chatted and were just kind of shooting the shit for a little bit. So that was always fun. It was very cool to meet you guys. The other funny thing to the tapings on Tuesday, we had second row seats. So the first time we were there, we had front row. That's what you saw on Thursday. This time, our seats were literally right behind where we were in June, only we're in the second row instead of the first row. And poor Webmaster Mike had to get the seat right behind the guy with the giant mohawk. So in about 2 weeks, when you're watching Impact and you see a guy with a giant mohawk in the front row, we're right behind him. Or I should say Webmaster Mike is directly behind him. Open with Gail Kim in a four-way, which is probably what they were teasing on Impact that aired this week. The four-way with Gail Kim, Taryn Terrell, Velvet Sky, and Angelina Love for the Knockouts Championship. Gail retained her title. Highlight of the match was Taryn Terrell doing a dive off the top rope onto the floor, onto all the heels. No idea when this was going to actually air. I'm guessing it's going to be in 2 weeks, but again, the way they mix and match stuff, who the hell knows? This match aired right before the Hardcore Justice taping, so they may shove this match into a random taping. It wasn't part of Hardcore Justice. Hardcore Justice began after this. Open with Bram and Abyss. Stairway to Janus match. Now, if you saw their match, Monsters Ball, on Thursday night, you know it was brutal, right? Blood, thumbtacks, barbed wire boards. This was worse. If you thought that match was rough, wait until you see this one. The first spot of the match, the first spot, was Bram being backdropped onto a ladder in the ring, and right off the bat, he had a nasty-looking gash on his back that just opened up. I mean, if you remember that time that Hardcore Holly had his back split wide open on an episode of ECW on Sci-Fi, this wasn't quite as bad, but it was similar. It was similar. And that was the first spot of the match, so now he's got to wrestle the rest of this hardcore match with his back sliced open. So he goes on the outside. He bladed. So now Bram is bleeding from the head. He got thrown into the barbed wire board back first and got sliced open. And then, as if that wasn't enough, with his back ripped open and bleeding towards the end of the match now, he got slammed down onto 1,000 thumbtacks. And there were tacks sticking in the open cut, in the open wound on his back. Abyss got shoved off a ladder onto a barbed wire board at another point. Bram got Janus. Janus was hanging above the ring. He climbed up and grabbed it. But before he could use it, Abyss caught him with a black hole slam on the thumbtacks. Just brutal. Brutal stuff. Eventually, Abyss got Janus. Bram kicked him in the nuts. He used Janus on Abyss. And, shot right to the gut. Got the pin. So basically, the same finish as the match you saw on Thursday. I'm not a fan of this kind of stuff, to this degree, at least. There's just no need to take it that far. Like I said earlier, for what? For TNA? You're going to rip your back open and shove thumbtacks in there for TNA? I mean, come on. But if you're into that sort of thing, this match will be right up your alley. EC3, Rockstar Spud, Rhino in the ring for an interview. Lots of fuck you, Rhino chants. I have video of it up on my Instagram page, for those of you who didn't see it. EC3 blamed Rhino for his Aunt Dixie going through a table. Rhino told him to take all of his money and shove it up his ass. So, big baby face turn for Rhino. A brawl broke out. EC3 laid out Rhino to set a matchup later on in the tapings between the two of them. Samoa Joe beat Low Ki with the Muscle Buster. You guys are going to enjoy this. This was stiff as hell, as you would expect from these two guys. Real good stuff. Mr. Anderson beat Sam Shaw in an I Quit match. Sam Shaw tapped out to an armbar. Yes, an armbar. He tapped out. Gunner came down to break it all up since Anderson wouldn't let go of the hold. He and Anderson had a brief stare down. Anderson's a dick. I don't know. It reads to me like Sam Shaw now is the babyface and Anderson is the dickish heel. I guess, I don't know if they've actually explained that, but that seems to be the role now. Hardy Boys interview. They were out there, Matt and Jeff. Jeff says they could do better. They haven't exactly had a lot of luck yet since they've reunited in TNA. So they invited Team 3D to come out. Bully says they're on a mission to become the TNA Tag Team Champions. What a way to go into the Hall of Fame this October in Japan as the Tag Team Champions. So they want to win the belts. They call out the Wolves. Davey Richards says that if they want a shot at the belts, they can have it anytime, anywhere. So they made a match for the main event, Hardys versus Dudleys versus Wolves. It's going to be the first match of a series where the first team to win two matches wins the series and the tag team titles. So we got the first match at the end of the show. Six Sides of Steel to determine the number one contender for Lashley's TNA title. We had Bobby Roode, Austin Aries, Eric Young, James Storm, Magnus, and Gunner. Roode and EY climbed out at the same time on opposite sides. They did the old Hogan-Orndorff finish from Saturday night's main event, only Eric Young clearly hit the floor first. It was just obvious that he did. That kind of screwed things up. They still played it up like they hit simultaneously, the referees argued, and that's how that ended. Then came a last knockout standing match between Gail Kim and Angelina Love. This opened the second taping. These two had a hell of a match. You really need to see it when it airs. It is worth going out of your way to see. They brawled all over ringside. They used cookie sheets on each other, ring steps. There was a spot on the outside where Gail went to use a chair on Angelina by the ramp. Angelina drilled her, just absolutely killed her with a kick to the face. Finish came with Gail giving Angelina a Samoan drop off the top rope down onto a steel chair that was laying on the mat. Love could not respond to the 10 count, and so Gail retained her title. Just great stuff. Major props to these two women. There were lots of better than divas chants during the match, and for one night anyway, they were. Tajiri made his TNA debut. He beat Robbie E with the green mist and the buzzsaw kick. I think he beat him with the kick. Tajiri pretty much looks the same as you would remember him, just a little bit older in the face. His hair is a little more unkempt. You know, it's been almost a decade since we've seen him on, WWE television. I think his last appearance, I'm guessing, would have been the first ECW One Night Stand pay-per-view, which would have been 2005. So it's been a while. It's been a while, but he looked good. Kurt Angle did a promo up in the balcony. Said that due to the photo finish in the cage match, we do not have a number one contender, but he's going to sit down with Bobby Roode and Eric Young to hash it out. Whatever the hell that means. MVP Kenny King and Lashley came to the ring. MVP had a line here where he told the fans to shut up before he has the NYPD start dishing out chokeholds to everybody. That got a reaction, not surprisingly. For those who don't live here and don't know, there was video recently of a police officer applying a chokehold to an unarmed suspect, and you could hear the guy on video saying, "He can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe," and he ended up passing out and he died. And they ruled his death a homicide. It's been a big, big story around here. So, you know, was it tasteless? Sure. Was it out of line? Not at all. He's a heel. It's not like he made a rape joke, you know. And I know death is worse than rape, but there are just some lines you don't cross. I didn't feel like this did. There were a few people who were upset, but for the most part, it was one of those reactions like, oh, like he went there. You know, but he was being a heel. He called Lashley the King of New York City. That brought out Tommy Dreamer, as if the amount of ECW nostalgia on these shows hasn't been nauseating enough. Once the Dixie angle played out, that should have been the end of Tommy Dreamer, but nope, he was back again on the show. This turned into a street fight between Dreamer and Lashley. Lashley just destroyed him. Crotched him right on the guardrail in front of us. Words cannot describe Lashley in person. He is just straight up beast. Not the beast incarnate, but still nobody you would want to meet in a dark alley. Lashley beat him with the spear. Crowd loved Dreamer. I mean, they ate it up. There were a lot of fans who were into the ECW nostalgia. I was not. You know, to each their own. I still feel like there's way too much of it on these shows. You did it the first few tapings, okay, when you're in New York City, right? You want to have some of the old ECW guys. That's fine. I get that. But here we are, another batch of tapings, and they just keep trotting the ECW guys out there. It's like, it worked here, but I don't ever have to see Tommy Dreamer on Impact ever again. Low-key, Tigre Uno and Crazy Steve beat Homicide Manic and DJ Zima when Low-key pinned Manic with the Key Crusher. Really fun match. Rhino beat EC3 by DQ after EC3 nailed him with a chair. He was nailing Rhino hard with those chair shots, and they were hitting him right on the elbow. So, like, Rhino was laying on his side. EC3 kept striking him with the chair, but the chair kept hitting him in the elbow. It was brutal. Next was a special segment with Kurt Angle introducing us to the newest TNA signing, Sergeant Chris Melendez, who got a fair amount of publicity for TNA in New York this week. He is an amputee, He lost his left leg in Iraq. He is the recipient of the Purple Heart. The Dudleys, Anderson were out there as well. Anderson is a former military man himself, which I did not know. And he talked about his favorite charity, the Wounded Warrior Project. He found out about this guy who wanted to be a wrestler. And he recommended that he hook up with Team 3D in their school out of Florida. So he referred Bully to this guy. And Bully told him, look, I'll train you for free, but you got to be serious about this. He took him up on it, and here we are. And they handed out little American flags to the crowd before the segment, everybody except Brian Blade. He was very upset he did not get a flag. So to make him feel better, me and Webmaster Mike waved our little flags in his face, like a modern-day version of the Fabulous Rougeaus when they went heel and they started doing their disingenuous We Love the USA gimmick. I still think their theme music is fantastic, by the way, if you've never heard it. Especially the part about Barry Manilow. That always cracks me up. Just Google it. Go on YouTube and listen to it. Main event was Hardys, Dudleys, and Wolves. Match one of their series. I heard they had great matches all three nights. Not shocked about that at all, given who was involved. Second match was a tables match. I think that was the night after our taping. And the third match was a ladder match. We got the straight match, and it was great. Dudley's won with the 3D on Eddie Edwards. So there's going to be a lot of good wrestling action coming up on Impact over the next several weeks. And if you're into the Hardys and the Dudleys, then you're going to really enjoy this. And I like the fact that they're working with the Wolves. I assume in the end the Wolves go over. You know, the two veteran popular teams put over the younger guys, you know, kind of the big top team of their generation. I dig that. I dig that story. So that was the tapings. Another fun night of wrestling. Say what you want to about TNA and what their future may or may not hold. They taped a bunch of TV. This TV is going to carry them through the end of their Spike TV contract. So this TV will carry them through the end of September. And we're just waiting for an announcement from either side. Are they going to be renewed or are they not going to be renewed? Because if they're not going to be renewed, they're going to have to find a new home. Or else it's going to be bad times for TNA. But if you have the chance to go to one of their shows, you'll always have fun. Even, you know, other house shows of theirs I've been to, no matter how big or small the crowd may be, it affords them the opportunity to do a lot of fan interaction, to have autograph signings. You can go into the ring and pose for photos with guys for $20. I mean, they do a lot of really good stuff like that that WWE just can't do. You just can't do that in a building with 5,000 people. It's a lot different if you have a building with 500 people. So they were doing some of that after the show. They brought out tables for an autograph signing. I didn't stick around, but a fun time. And supposedly they've already booked dates or at least put in a reservation for some dates to go back to the Manhattan Center again for another set of three tapings in September. I don't think it's officially been booked yet because they're probably just waiting to see how things play out with Spike. I mean, why are you going to go back to the Manhattan Center in a month and tape six more hours of TV if you don't have a TV deal? So I think they put a hold on the building. If they re-sign, then they'll probably be back in New York City again. And I guess the weird thing about that is, if they do come back and they tape TV, they have Bound for Glory coming up in Japan. I think October 12th is the date. That's their next big pay-per-view. That's like their WrestleMania, okay? So I'm just wondering, if they've already taped television through the end of September, and the plan, let's say, is to go back to the Manhattan Center in September for more tapings that would then take them through October, possibly even into November. That poses a very risky situation, I would think, because you're potentially going to have to spoil the outcome of the pay-per-view for the people who go to your tapings. So I don't really know how that's going to work, but I just heard, you know, there were reports that they've put a hold on the building for September. I would have to assume it's for TV and not just for a house show. I guess we'll just wait and see. Let's get to the mailbag and your questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. That is the email address for any and all questions, including MP3 audio questions. Please, when you write in, include your name and where you are from. Jason from Juneau, Alaska, has an audio question for us.
Hey, Solomonster, it's Jason from Juneau, Alaska, dropping you a line. Got a couple of questions for you about Alberto Del Rio and his firing from WWE. Is this a boon for TNA? Maybe they go after Alberto Del Rio, add him to the roster, make it a little bit stronger for them? And is this just another convenient excuse for the WWE, regarding the circumstances surrounding his firing, to cut a guy that they already had plans on cutting anyway?
Jason's a radio man, I could tell. Is it a boon for TNA? It could be if they sign him, if he really is gone. I think him and Ricardo would have to come in together, though. I think on his own, they could do something with him. I just, you know, he's got that missing ingredient to him. He's kind of bland, and I feel like he needs to come in with a manager or a mouthpiece. Ricardo would be perfect in that role. It just so happens they're now going to be free agents at the same time. It would just make total sense for wherever they end up to go together. So I think it would be a boon for TNA to get the both of them. But it's not going to change anything as far as their fortunes go. We've seen them bring in Hulk Hogan, Sting, Kurt Angle, Ric Flair, I mean Booker T, Kevin Nash, Scott Steiner, everybody under the sun, and not one person has really made a lick of difference. So I don't know that I would say it's a big boon, but if they're going to do it right and bring both of them in together. Is it a convenient excuse for WWE to cut a guy they were going to cut anyway? I don't think they were going to cut him. I think they very much wanted to keep him around. The stories were that he was very unhappy with his position in the company. And so when his contract was up, there was some debate as to whether or not Del Rio would choose to stay or maybe go back to Mexico and do something else. So by no means do I think they wanted to cut him. I don't think they wanted to cut him at all. I think it was just the opposite, where they were worried about him maybe walking when his contract was over. And I guess they beat him to the punch with what happened here. Here's another audio question, this one from Steven in New Jersey.
What up, Solid Monster? My name is Steven. I am from New Jersey. My question is the following. Word is that apparently the Manhattan Center has raised the prices to rent inside the building. And with that being said, Ring of Honor may not be coming back to the Hammerstein Ballroom, especially for December's final battle. Now, Ring of Honor is to come back to New York. What venue do you see them using for final battle? I personally feel that they could use the theater at MSG, the same theater that was used for the 1998 SummerSlam Lion's Den match between and Shamrock versus Owen Hart. What do you think about this? Do you think it could work?
My understanding is that they're not running the Manhattan Center anymore because the rent is just astronomical. I mean, the rates they wanted to rent that building out to them were just far too high. I would think that the theater at Madison Square Garden would probably also not be too cheap. So it would be weird. I mean, the Garden is literally a block away from the Manhattan Center. They're virtually in the same spot. They're in the same area. And it's the heart of New York City. You're still talking Madison Square Garden. There's still that connection. It's not the actual Garden. But if they're not running the Manhattan Center because of financial issues and they don't want to pay the rent, then I would be shocked if they went to the theater and they were getting a better rate. The theater has plenty of seats. I mean, it fits, I think, 5,500 people is the capacity there. They could do that, but I'm just guessing that for money reasons alone, the answer to that is probably no. Court Bauer, who works for Ring of Honor, was on Twitter this past week teasing a big announcement coming up soon with respect to where Ring of Honor would find a new home in New York City. So we're going to find out very soon, maybe as early as this week. I think there's a pretty good chance Final Battle. I think Final Battle has already been announced as being in New York City, I think. I just don't think they've announced a location. So we'll find out very soon, but I would be kind of surprised if they ended up at the theater at MSG. Lee Watts from Warwickshire, England. What are your thoughts on the rivalry between Chris Jericho and William Regal during the early part of 2001? That was always one of my favorite rivalries, and I always enjoyed the matches they had, especially at Backlash that year when they had a Duchess of Queensberry rules match where, if memory serves me right, Regal made up the rules as the match went along. It was fun. It was fun for what it was. I can't say that it's a favorite feud of mine. I can't even say that I found it really all that exciting. I got a chuckle out of the whole Duchess of Queensberry match. I think they had somebody dressed up as the Queen sitting at ringside. It was kind of dumb, but they were kind of making it up as they went along. I think they opened the show at WrestleMania 17, I want to say, for the Intercontinental title. I felt that was a waste of Jericho. It was just, it was an opening match that wasn't all that great. I think that the two of them could probably have better matches together. Also, he says, when does a chant from a crowd become disrespectful to the wrestlers? When do they cross the line between harmless fun and disrespect? Well, I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, one of the chants, if not the chant that I hate the most, and I think is the most disrespectful, is the "you fucked up" chant. You know, it became a thing in the old ECW. People still do it to this day. It was weird because I was at one of the TNA tapings. I don't remember if it was the most recent one or the one before that. Somebody did mess up. And there were a few times where people chanted, "you fucked up," but there was something else that happened. And clearly somebody did mess up, but the fans like didn't want to disrespect them, so they kind of bit their tongue and they didn't say anything. I wish more crowds would be like that. I mean, there's just nothing to be gained. There's nothing but disrespect from a chant like that. So I was never a fan of the "you fucked up" chant. And I, you know what? I'll call out another chant here. "You still got it." I gotta say something about this. That's another chant, I think, much like "this is awesome," that has been completely bastardized. I mean, nowadays you'll see matches where somebody throws a drop kick in the first 30 seconds. "That was awesome. This is awesome." Like, shut up. The "you still got it" chant, I think, borders on disrespect now when people use it more often than not. They'll use it in situations with guys who never really went away or aren't really that old. Like, there's no reason to think they ever lost it. And I wonder, a lot of times when those guys hear those chants, maybe not a Jericho, although maybe you could use him as an example, but when you're a guy like that who hears a chant like that, I wonder what's going through their mind. Because I know the intent on the part of the fans is positive. Like, they mean well by it. They're not trying to be disrespectful or disingenuous when they say that. I just think a misplaced "you still got it" chant can be very disrespectful, depending on who you say it to and when. It depends on the circumstance. So I would throw that out there as well. And then, of course, there's the "what" chant, which serves no purpose other than to just be annoying and disrespectful. And I would 100% be in favor of WWE taking the biggest, baddest man on their roster, sending them out into the crowd whenever somebody chants "what," and physically removing them from the premises. I know they can't do that, but I wish they would. Howard from Boreham Wood, England. Man, I have more UK fans than the WWE Network. "I read recently that Hulk Hogan is training for one more match and he wants it to be against John Cena. I know Hogan having a match is unlikely anyway, with the chances of WWE doctors passing him fit to compete very slim, but I was thinking about it, and it actually would not be too bad of an idea. If it does happen, it would most likely be at WrestleMania 31, which would mean that Cena would be kept out of any title matches or main event final card matches, so that many people are bored of seeing him would like that. Secondly, it would make the card look very strong with the potential Sting vs. Undertaker match, coupled with Hogan vs. Cena, so that could draw people to buy the pay-per-view or subscribe to the network. What are your thoughts?" My thoughts are this. Hogan has always claimed that there's going to be one more match. I think if Hogan were on his deathbed with tubes hooked up to him, he would still be saying, "One more match, brother, one more match. It's going to happen, never say never," and then he would croak. But, you know, he has to say that. He has to keep hope alive, right? He wants to keep people thinking that one day there'll be another Hulk Hogan match because it keeps him relevant. And maybe in his mind he really does think that. Maybe he really is training for a match at WrestleMania next year. I predict that even if that's his intent, there's no way they'll clear him to wrestle a match. I can't see it. 8 back surgeries, the way he walks around, they're going to clear him, medically clear him for a match? I don't see it. Now, if they did, and it was going to be a smoke and mirrors type of deal, yeah, Hogan vs. Cena would be a big time match. I think it would be a draw. I think there's enough people out there who maybe don't know the extent of Hogan's injuries or just don't care. He's still a big enough name and a big enough star, and if they build it up as the true final match of Hulk Hogan, like, this is it. After a 35-year career, this will be his final match, so you better order the show, you better buy a ticket. I definitely think it would be a draw. I don't think it would be a good match, but it would be a draw. That, Sting versus Undertaker, if they do it again, may not be a good match, but definitely would be a draw. But you better have a hell of a third match to round out that top of the card. If you're going to put Hogan vs. Cena and Sting vs. Undertaker on the same show, even with all the star power, as much of a draw as those matches may be, match quality is going to leave a lot to be desired. So you better have like a big-time, guaranteed, blockbuster in-ring match to carry the load at the top of that card. And I'm not sure Brock Lesnar against Roman Reigns is that match. So I think they may have to go in a different direction if that were to actually happen. But again, I don't think Hogan's going to ever be cleared for a match in that company ever again. So it's a moot point. Tom from Latvia. "My question is about Drew Galloway, a.k.a. Drew McIntyre. Recently, I listened to Chris Jericho's podcast where he was interviewed. I really became a fan of his. Most of his time in WWE was pretty rough, with his mother passing away and all. He seems like a very intelligent, driven guy. When do you think we will see him back in WWE? Another question about Drew I have is the storyline he had back in 2011, where he was trying not to get fired every week by Teddy Long, It made little to no sense to me. Well, welcome to WWE. I kind of barely remember that storyline. Again, I haven't paid close attention to SmackDown in many, many years, but I do remember that. That, I think, was the beginning of his descent from being pushed to not being pushed. As far as when I think we'll see him back in WWE, I hope we do. I don't think it would be for a few years. I think he's working the independents now. He just beat Chris Hero to win the Evolve title at a show this past weekend. I saw the video of him when he made his big comeback in that Irish promotion. They hid him the whole time, so it was a big secret. Nobody knew he was there. The lights went out. The lights came back on. There was Drew Galloway. The place went nuts. He cut a great promo. It just goes to show you how there are guys on that roster, even now, still in WWE, who have the kind of potential that this guy has, who would probably shine anywhere else, and they're just being held down because there's no role for them, because they're low on the totem pole. We have other things going on. Or maybe the guys are going to creative with ideas, and they're getting shot down. You know, Daniels and Kazarian said the same thing about TNA. They've done some shoot interviews, and they talked about their time in TNA. And they were constantly bringing ideas to John Gaborik and other people in creative, and they were just being shot down. Or they would be like, oh, okay, this is great, and then nothing would happen. Same thing happens in WWE. How many of those guys are actually coming up with great ideas that are getting shot down? We don't know. Maybe Drew was one of those guys. I don't know how vocal he was. A lot of guys probably are too afraid to be vocal. They got to walk on eggshells now. They're trying to cut $40 million from their budget. Everyone's job is on the line. Mark Eaton got fired. You know, nobody's safe. So you walk around on eggshells all day, and you're afraid to say anything. That sounds like a pretty shitty work environment to me. I don't care how much money you make. So Drew would be best served, I think, to keep doing what he's doing. He's getting out there. He's working independence. I heard him in an interview this past week say that the ultimate goal for him would be to go to New Japan. They do have a number of American stars, and I don't know if they have any UK people on the roster right now over in New Japan. But they definitely have foreigners that they bring in that were even in the G1 tournament. And Drew in New Japan would be huge for him. You know, it's certainly been huge for AJ Styles and a lot of those guys. So I think he needs to just do that and keep wrestling and keep on, you know, impressing people. And eventually, hopefully, WWE will take notice and will have a role for him and they'll bring him back. Their track record of bringing back guys, like they did that with Chris Masters, it's not a great track record once they let go of you. So what would his future hold in WWE, even if they brought him back? I hate to say it. If they ever brought him back, he probably would be right back in the comedy spot on the card. I really have a tough time envisioning Drew McIntyre one day returning to WWE and being pushed as anything serious. So the best thing for him right now may be to get into New Japan and keep wrestling all over the place and just really make a name for himself and make himself a hot commodity so that one day WWE has no choice but to take notice and to make him an offer. And if he wants, maybe he'll be in a position at that point to play some hardball and say, you know what, that's not good enough. You want me? Here's what I want. That's the problem with having only one real wrestling company left in this country anyway. You lose all your leverage because where else are you going to go? I mean, TNA is still alive right now, and as it is, they're a joke. So if they go away, it's not going to make that much of a difference really, but there's going to be a lot of guys out of work and guys who burn bridges in Ring of Honor and other places who aren't going to have any place to go, and it's going to suck. That's why I don't want to see TNA go under. Jarvis from Toronto. My question is about Jeff Hardy and his possible future WWE return. Much like Batista, Jeff Hardy was a big name in WWE, even the number two guy at one point. As we witnessed earlier this year, sometimes times change so drastically that even the most popular stars from the past, Batista being a perfect example of this, will get mixed reactions when they return. Do you think this will happen to Jeff Hardy if he comes back? No, I don't. I do expect to see Jeff Hardy back in WWE at some point, especially if TNA does go under, and there's no way he's getting booed by those fans. There's no way. He's not getting a Batista reaction. Trey from California, my question is about the Benoit vs. Guerrero match at One Night Stand 05. Why did Eddie look legitimately upset with Benoit and not even come out with the rest of the ECW originals at the end of the show? Well, I don't know why he didn't come out, but I remember that match as being really disappointing. I expected a lot more out of that match, and I got the sense watching it that they felt the same way. They felt they could have put on a better match. There may have been some botches during the match. You know, Eddie could be very hot-headed and have a short fuse, as we saw in the ladder match at SummerSlam with Rey Mysterio when Vicky missed her time cues. So I think that probably had a lot to do with it. I just remember that match being very disappointing, and I know those two guys really were very critical of their own performances whenever they wrestled, and I would imagine they probably weren't too thrilled with the match they had that night. Matt from Chicago, during the Sound Off last week, episode 339, you alluded to the fact that when Chris Jericho first started with WWE, he had issues getting over because of backstage politics, and specifically he had issues with Triple H. Can you discuss this in detail? What were the issues between the two of them? What did Triple H say or do to Jericho when he broke into the company? Why exactly did Triple H have problems with Chris Jericho? Jericho touched on it in his second book, told some stories. It was more just razzing and stuff like that. So, for example, Jericho remembers Triple H telling him when he first came into the company, hey, give me a call if you ever need anything, you know, which is a nice thing for him to do. And one day, Jericho, who wasn't really familiar with some of the new buildings that WWE ran, you know, they weren't buildings that WCW ran. So one day he got lost. He didn't know where to go. He didn't know how to get to the building. And so Jericho called Triple H to ask him if he had directions to the arena. And Triple H told him, yes, I do. Get a map. And he hung up on him. You know, there's also the case of WrestleMania 2000. And I don't think Jericho talked about this in his book. And I'm not even sure 100% if this is the story. It is a fact that Jericho was originally supposed to be in that Fatal 4-Way match at WrestleMania 16. It was going to be Rock, Triple H, Jericho, and Big Show. That is a fact. There are pay-per-view posters that were produced that had Jericho's face on them. At some point, plans changed. Okay, the buck stops with Vince McMahon. He made the call. Plans changed. Mick Foley, who had just lost a Hell in a Cell match the month before and considered himself to be legitimately done, he was retired, he got called back, which made him look stupid, and he wasn't even in shape. He really had no business being in that match at WrestleMania. Foley, you know, he did that dive off the top rope, and he missed the table. He looked bad. So Foley ended up taking Jericho's spot, and I had always been under the impression from stories that I had read that Triple H may have had something to do with that. He may have influenced the decision to have Jericho removed from the main event. He's not ready, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that also could have been some involvement that Triple H had with the early part of Jericho's career. I just think Triple H was working hard to get over as a main event guy. Okay, when Jericho came in, it was the summer of 99. That was when Triple H was first getting his first big break. Austin didn't want to lose the title to him, I guess, at SummerSlam, so he lost it to Foley. Foley dropped the belt the next night to Triple H. That was the month, that same month that Jericho debuted, Triple H won his first WWE championship. People still didn't buy him as a main event guy. I still didn't buy him as a main event guy. I didn't buy him as a champion and a main event guy until the Foley feud in early 2000, after that street fight at the Royal Rumble. That made me a believer, and I became a fan of heel Triple H that year. In my opinion, still his best year was the year 2000. But he was working very hard during that time to get over as a main event player. Finally, after all these years, and Triple H went through some political nonsense himself with the whole curtain call incident, and he got punished, and he was supposed to win King of the Ring in 96, and they took it away from him. So he had been through some similar stuff himself earlier in his career. And there was also a lot of competition with him and The Rock. I'm sure a lot of jealousy there. So there was that. I don't know Triple H personally. I can't tell you whether he's the jealous type or what the deal was. Certainly back then, I'm sure there was a lot of that going on. And so here's Chris Jericho, this guy coming in from WCW, this young guy with all of this fanfare. And it's not a stretch to think that Triple H saw this guy as competition. He saw his spot potentially being threatened. You know, I know when Jericho got programmed with China a few months after he came into the company, and this he does talk about in his book, you know, Triple H in China would go to Vince McMahon and complain that Jericho was hurting her in the ring, and Jericho would get chewed out for it. Well, I mean, you put a woman in the ring with a guy, what do you expect? Jericho, he goes into more detail in his book as far as those meetings with Vince are concerned. You wonder how much of that, again, was Triple H prodding her to go to Vince and get him into trouble. So that's kind of what happened early on in the game. Now, as far as I know, they're friendly, all is well. There was the story, I want to say it was back in 2007, when Jericho first came back to the company. He was gone for 2 years. A famous story floating around that there was a house show, and backstage at the house show, Triple H made a comment to the effect of, "Hey, Chris Jericho is here to save us," like save business and all that kind of stuff. So I honestly, I don't know what Triple H really thinks of Chris Jericho. He'll speak complimentary of him now, as he should, because Triple H is the heir apparent to the throne. He's like the boss now in many ways. I mean, Vince is still the boss, but yeah, Triple H is an executive in the company, and he has to negotiate with these guys and work with these guys, and I'm sure he and Chris Jericho have a very good relationship now, but you always wonder deep down what they really think about each other. This comes from Burgess, who has a worthy wrestling cause to tell us about, and we'll end with this. I wanted to share it with you guys. He says, "I've been recently volunteering for an organization based out of North Carolina called New School Wrestling, school with a K. They are unique in that they are a nonprofit wrestling company. They have in the past put on shows to raise funds for the Wounded Warrior Project, Autism Speaks, local education programs, and a myriad of other causes. We are trying to get out our name. We take bookings much the same way a band would, and then use that money, paired with advertising of local businesses, to raise money for these causes. Anybody looking for more information can visit the NSW page on Facebook, which is facebook.com/newschoolwrestling. Again, that's school, S-K-O-O-L. And anyone interested in booking NSW can contact Will Getling, 336-391-5209. And you can find all the information on their website. Check it out. It's pretty cool that these guys are doing that. Nonprofit, very unique. And so I wanted to give them a little bit of publicity here. And also I want to promote Craig McNamee on our Facebook group page has an elimination post going. Anybody in our Facebook group, you'll know what that is. So find his post on there. That would make him feel very happy if you were to participate in that thread. Before we end here, we have this week's sad tweet, which was only posted about 2 hours ago, actually, as I am recording the show. He posted it to Twitter and to Instagram. I'm reading it off his Instagram. This comes from @TheRock, Dwayne Johnson. He posted, "My mom and cousin were struck head-on by a drunk driver this week. They lived. First reaction is to find the person who did this and do unrelenting harm to them. But then you realize the most important thing is my family lived through this and we can hug each other that much tighter these days. Hug your own family tighter today and be grateful you can tell them you love them." Really sad to hear that they were in that accident. I hope they're okay. Obviously they survived. I don't know the extent of their injuries. He didn't say. I believe Rock's cousin, and he links to her Twitter profile, is a diva in the developmental system for WWE. So they seem to be okay, but he's got a picture up here of the accident. You look at this photo, and it's actually quite amazing they lived. It's almost a miracle. And hopefully they'll be okay. And, there's nothing that makes me angrier than hearing these stories about these drunken morons who get behind the wheel of a car and they go on the road and they put other people's lives in danger. You know, it's one of the reasons why I used to go off on Matt Hardy back in the day. Matt Hardy was really screwed up. He had a lot of problems going on in his life. And that's fine, right? Everybody has problems. You try to get help for your problems, and hopefully you can kick them, your demons, whatever. But what would piss me off about Matt Hardy was we would hear these stories about him getting pulled over for drunk driving. And there was one story I remember where he was like riding to the airport to pick up Rebby Sky, who's now his wife, and he was like behind a car that had a family in it or something. Like you hate hearing about that because you're just being so selfish when you do something like that. And thankfully Matt's cleaned himself up and he seems to be doing well. But there's far too many idiots who get behind the wheel of a car when they're batshit drunk and have no business being on the road, and they're being selfish and they're putting other people's lives at risk. And you hear stories about drunk driving accidents where the drunk driver walks away without a scratch on him and the other person is dead. And it pisses me the hell off. It's just one of those things that just gets under my skin every time I hear about that. So at least here there's a happy ending in that they both survived. Hopefully they'll be okay. Rock's mom is a tough lady. She's been around for a long time. She used to promote wrestling matches. She was not somebody that you wanted to mess with back in the day. So good to hear that, but still very sad that they were in that accident. If you have questions for the mailbag, you could email them to me. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the place to email me any questions, suggestions, inquiries, anything of that nature. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is the handle. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster is my official profile page. We have a closed discussion group on Facebook. If you type in the full name of the podcast, you'll find it. You have to apply for membership. And just bear with me as I go through each request and pick only the people who I feel would really add something to our group. I'm adding people slowly but surely there. YouTube, we're on YouTube. Type in the full name of the podcast. You'll find our channel. Please subscribe to us there. Please keep streaming the show on Stitcher Radio. We slipped a little bit in the rankings this week. The more people who stream the show through Stitcher, the more it helps our ranking. So if you're downloading the show via other means, it doesn't really have any effect on our Stitcher ranking. So every now and then, think of us on there. Stream us on there. We're also on TuneIn Radio as well. You can make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. And the right-hand side, you'll see the donation box. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. And thank you to everybody who also signed up for Audible Trials. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster is our custom URL. A few of you people have actually recommended friends and family to sign up, even though they don't listen to the podcast. That's pretty cool. And you can do that, by the way. Again, it doesn't cost them anything. If you have a family member, a friend, your mom, somebody like that is an avid reader, maybe they like audiobooks, maybe they've never tried an audiobook before, you can recommend to them and suggest to them that they use our URL and sign up through there, and it helps the podcast out, and who knows, maybe they make maybe Audible makes a new fan. You know, they've got a great service. So that's our link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster, so please check us out there. We had a really good July. Hopefully we'll have an even better August. And that's about it. We'll be back next weekend for a brand new episode. We'll have SummerSlam predictions. It is the big pay-per-view coming up next Sunday in Los Angeles. So that'll be episode 341 of The Sound Off. Thank you guys for making this podcast work every single week. Everybody who tunes in, you have made this show a big success, and I thank you for that. So until next time, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. Enjoy the Hulk Hogan birthday bash this Monday night, and we will see you right back here for a brand new episode of The Sound Off next weekend. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to The Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Charlotte into the cover on Natalya! Charlotte's the NXT Women's Champion!
The bad.
We officially strip Daniel Bryan of the WWE World Heavyweight Championship.
It's a good night to be right.
And the ugly.
I made the mistake of reading Vince Russo's blog. He talks about how it's not creative. No, it's the crowds that are dead, and it's all theme park visitors who come inside because it's too hot outside. 900 people did not wander into the fucking impact zone because grandma was about to keel over from heat stroke.
Well, mostly the good.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007. On thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.